Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how we as a planetary civilization are moving into new realities, new frontiers of being. And that has to do with how we as a planet are moving into new territory within the galaxy. We are uncovering new parts of ourselves. But particularly tonight, in this opening interview, I'll be talking to some good friends, some frequent guests to the show, Drs. J.J. Hertog, Drs. Desiree Hertog, and we're going to talk about the meteor or asteroid that's on its way into Earth's orbit that should be here Friday. It's supposed to be about the size of a football field, and it's not going to hit the Earth, as people have said, but it is going to come very close, well within the moon's orbit and well within the orbits of many satellites. So I'm going to be talking to the Hertogs about what that means. Is there anything to worry about? What's the history of asteroids impacting the Earth, and what we should look forward to this Friday? Welcome, Dr. J.J. Hertog, Dr. Desiree Hertog.
Welcome to our worldwide audience, and thank you very much for having us aboard on this momentous occasion where we must be aware of the phenomena of asteroids, comets, and things that could literally change the planetary field of life as we know it.
Well, tell us exactly what is going to happen, because you've done the research, both of you, and I know we don't have anything to worry about, but if we should worry about it, what would we worry about?
Well, I'd like to dedicate this program to Gene Shoemaker, a well-known geologist, father of archaeogeology, a former professor at Caltech in California, who put forth the notion that there would be these cataclysmic events, great events from space, meteorite, as well as asteroid events that could trigger the, shall we say, destruction of civilization, certainly connected with the Chicxulub events that we now have confirmed through other research that's going on. But Gene Shoemaker really set the high bar for looking at this as a very important field of scientific investigation.
Right. So about a year ago, actually February 22nd of last year, the people in university or the observatory in La Sangre in southern Spain actually saw this near-Earth orbit of this asteroid. That means it's coming close towards us. And they put an alarm out and they started analyzing it. You have to get the trajectories to see where and when it's coming. And one of the planetary societies, which is very big here, it's called the Planetary Society, actually helped fund some of the research for analyzing this comet. And what's it, I should say, this asteroid. That's very important because it's called 2012, because that's when it was discovered, and DA14. It's just the number, DA14, and it really is an asteroid.
Okay. Now tell me, how big is it, and when do they expect it to approach the Earth?
Right, so it's about 45.7 miles long. And that...
No, meters.
Meters.
Go ahead. So half a football field.
It's something that's anticipated to pass the Earth on this Friday, the 15th, somewhere between 1900 hours and 2200 hours, that will be seen in Asia and South Africa, in that eastern part of the planet as we stand here in southern Northern California.
Okay, so, but will we be? We won't be able to see it, as reports say.
We can't see it, but the people over in Europe perhaps can see it, and the people in Australia and the Far East can see it in the early morning. So it's actually going to be visible from certain parts of the planet.
What will they see if they see this thing in the sky?
Well, basically, there's particular star constellations they need to look towards, especially at the night sky. And that's connected around Virgo and Leo, that area. And what they also need to look at is, for an object, it's actually moving, but it's moving about the size of a moon width.
Every 15 minutes.
Every 15 minutes. So you can see something that's going about the size of a moon width.
I should recalculate that to three hours.
Every 3 hours. Okay. No, but it's going, it will look kind of slow. because mostly, not that it's going slow, because it's actually going quite fast. It's technically going 26,000 miles an hour as it passes, but because it is quite far away. What's interesting is how far away it is. It's farther than the space station, but it, as you said, it's not as far as the moon. It's between the space station and the moon. It's actually in the orbit area of where we have some of our satellites, so we're going to have to watch that. But I don't think even the NASA scientists are not concerned about it coming close enough to disturb any of our satellites.
Well, I have a lot of questions for you. First of all, that's pretty close for an object. If an object that size were to hit the Earth, what kind of damage would it do?
Well, I just want to say the position that it's going to be is about 17,200 miles away. And so it's not going to hit again for sure. But it's similar to what happened in the area of Siberia in 1908 in Tunguska.
And that's part of Siberia. Events were recorded some 600 miles away. There was a radius of thousands of trees that were basically brought quickly down to the surface of the earth. Nomadic groups were tossed in their tents off the surface of the earth. It was really an event that would have been tragic for Western or Central Europe had it been in any other place except Siberia. But that evidence has been looked at by Russian scientists in the 20s and 30s that would have had catastrophic events. And this is really the point I want to make, is even though this is small by measurements, still the events that it could trigger in terms of tsunamis, supersonic wind bursts, wildfires, even earthquake-like tremors would be enough to bring down large city areas. So we're very thankful that this is just simply going to fly by, according to most experts, without any real serious damage,
right,
except
right.
Possibly through satellite in orbit.
So this is quite different from, it's 45.7 meters wide. This is different from what hit in the area of Merida. And I know, Alan, we were all there together recently. This is a very major place. That was a 10-kilometer diameter asteroid. Now, that's a lot different. 10 kilometers from 45 meters, so, you know, meters to kilometers. It's really just hundreds of times larger in that sense. But the bottom line on that was what wiped out the dinosaurs. This size of an asteroid would simply, if it hit like central New York, could destroy the city of New York. But for the most part, it's really only affects about, 500-mile radius, something like that.
Right. So there have been that one that hit in 1908 in Tunguska. Did they actually find the asteroid? Because I heard they never found anything there. They just saw the forest that was flattened, but there was no evidence of an asteroid.
Well, talking to Russian geologists and explorers, they did not find any direct evidence, and that led to an interesting statement that was in the Izvestia back in the late 1960s, and repeated again in the 70s, that the Tunguska event was the result of an explosion of an extraterrestrial ship over Russia. This triggered the imagination of Fred Singer, who was one of the great planetary scientists and one who just lectured recently to the Mars Society. This got him interested in these super phenomenal events from space, but the Russian story about the ET explosion, of course, was purely bogus to charm, as it were, those people interested in this type of situation. It was clearly an event that was natural in impact. The scope in terms of demographics would have been horrendous any other place on the planet.
Well, just to get back to the UFOs, I want to say that after my talk with you tonight, I'll be talking to Grant Cameron, who is very much investigating the UFO cover-up that's been going on the last few years. But there's no, you don't think this asteroid is a UFO that's coming our way. It's definitely...
Absolutely not.
In fact, it plans to come back once again in the trajectory. And this is not uncommon for certain asteroids where they come and they go. You know, Halley's Comet, certain ones of these, they've been known to come and go. I just want to say, since we're talking about UFOs, and of course some people do think that the Siberian asteroid crater could have been a UFO that crash landed there. We're going to be also talking at a UFO conference in the Ozarks. It's Ozark UFO Conference, April 12th to 14th, if anyone's interested. You know, we can discuss some of these factors. But, you know, we have to realize there's a lot out there in the universe. There's lots of asteroids. In fact, there's tens of thousands in the asteroid belt. That's that planet, that area between Mars and Jupiter that might have been a planet. Some people called it Malduk that broke apart. This is not really a popular astronomic idea since there's not that much asteroid material there, but it could have been a planet that really got blown apart. We know that we had a meteorite that landed here that the scientists feel came from Mars. And so, you know, you wonder how a meteorite could have come from Mars. But if there was enough of a volcano or some other asteroid, something, you know, made something leave the atmosphere and it came over here. So there's lots of stuff out there.
So, I mean, your organization is Future Science. There's a lot of spiritual, and I mean, it's a very spiritually based organization. Is there anything, I mean, we have the physical evidence or something's coming this way. How does this reflect, not astrologically wise, but on a more conscious level, our place in the galaxy and who we are as more multidimensional beings, in a sense? Does it have anything to do with that?
Well, we recognize that our universe in large is friendly towards evolution. In other words, our evolutionary event of life is a jackpot event that the right evidence for evolutionary processes came together. And I would like to emphasize the positive outlook toward the future. I do think that these events can happen at any time. In fact, there could be, according to Gene Shoemaker, upwards of 2,000 different asteroid events that could strike the Earth at any time in terms of crossing into our space. But nonetheless, we are on a positive move towards a dimension of an extraterrestrial imperative from Earth into space, into human habitats in our solar system and beyond.
Right. So the Keys of Enoch actually do not warn us, per se, about an asteroid hitting the planet and destroying us like they destroyed the dinosaurs. We feel, I always say, if it hit in the past, it might not hit again. Of course, it can hit again because it already hit once. But there's tons of asteroids out there, tons of comets that come out from the Oort cloud, which is at the far end of the solar system. And, you know, they come around in large periods of time, sometimes 4,000, even 40,000-year trajectories. But with all that said, you know, life might have been formed here, at least water and the primitive bacteria, from these asteroids and comets that have come by and have struck our planet. And what you're asking, though, Alan, is what about this energy coming right now?
Yeah.
Because we know that the moon affects us. Women can often feel that energy, full moon. There's even sometimes high crime rates going on at the time of the full moon, and maybe many people at the hospitals. And now, this is a smaller object than the moon, but it's coming even closer. So there very well could be some sort of energetic effect affecting the consciousness of people on the planet.
Well, what would that be? Would it be a positive energetic thing or a negative energetic thing?
It would definitely be a positive. And I think the whole concept here of being, shall we say, on the red line, the tarmac, looking for events in space, even though this is an interesting flyby, allows us to be more aware of the signatures of life in space and the fact that we must open our horizons to grasp the fact that we are, shall we say, participants on one planet, but also having options to move to others, allows us to be more aware of our guiding systems.
Well, I think that's one of the most important things about recognizing that the Earth is moving through interstellar space. Things are not just normal and routine. We are we're really coming into something new, and there's a greater awareness because of our technology that we are what you've said, galactic-based beings. So,
right, we are going into the state of what I call Homo Galacticus, galactic, yes, humanity, realizing indeed there are places in space that could be considered null zones. There are situations in space that are far more dangerous in terms of meteorite bombardment. But we do know from the meteors that we've recovered from the Antarctic region, such as the Allen Hills 84001, that these meteorite materials and asteroid materials can serve to bring the life-giving DNA towards new planetary systems. So these are triggering mechanisms of life more so than death. I like to emphasize the process of realizing that these are stepping stones to building a greater, should we say, roadmap of the heavens.
So in a sense, it could be putting us in touch with something much greater, since it has traveled here, perhaps from the asteroid belt, has traveled here before from around the sun. It's been there, and now it's coming close to us. So that energy of where it's been is now coming towards us and being close to us. So I'm sure we're picking up on some of that, of just the energy of what it is.
Well, I also think you made an important point, the fact that scientists also think that many of the comets that may have hit the Earth actually brought the oceans to the Earth here, because there's a lot of icy material around these comets, and we could have been impacted by one. But the idea is that the Earth is not isolated. We think we are on some idyllic separate sort of being here, or entity or planet that doesn't interface with the rest of the universe, but there is a huge interface, and we've been ignorant of that as a civilization. I think this asteroid and its approach, and I don't know how big it's really gotten in the media, because I don't think they want to scare people, but we need to understand, and I think that's your work, that we are part of a greater environment, a greater ecology, a galactic ecology. And that's the key that I want to bring out in doing an interview like this.
Right. And oftentimes these asteroids or the meteors are when they come through the atmosphere, which this one's not getting close to, so we'll call it an asteroid, which is the proper term. But it does probably have certain types of possibly amino acids that were instrumental in sharing life with the universe. So perhaps some of that energy is also coming towards us.
Now, I just have a question. Is there any talk from NASA about sending a ship up there, or like the space satellite, the space station, one of the Challenger, or one of those, you know, NASA-based rockets to intercept or meet this asteroid as it's coming? Has there been talk about that?
Well, no, I think they're not going to do it for this one. But, of course, they are really on standby. If any one of these asteroids were coming head-on to the Earth, I think that they are prepared to go up there in some fashion, some capacity, and try to move it off of its orbit or even explode it completely, depending on what size it is.
There was a movie about that called Meteorite with Bruce Willis. Did you see that? That's exactly what happened. They sent us.
I think Bruce Willis can take a sigh of relief and a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Regarding this event. But Jet Propulsion Lab, where I consulted one time, had a weather data processing software in terms of meteorological processing. And they looked at all sorts of possibilities of, shall we say, the movements of near-Earth objects, what this would hold in terms of new discovery, the elements of life that could possibly be improved upon in terms of the knowing of the life-giving chemistry that is coming in our direction. In short, we are at a stepping stage here of looking at a much greater philosophy of science in terms of astrobiology, and the whole aspect of this small event can lead to very outstanding launches in the near future.
I have to say, though, that we were last year when we were there for the Mars landing of the Curiosity rover, what was very interesting as we were talking with other scientists and people connected with some of the big names out here in Silicon Valley, connected with eBay and other places like Yahoo, they're looking at a real proposal to take a spaceship, or it will be like a unmanned probe, probably to the area of the asteroids belt, and that is just beyond Mars before Jupiter, and look at mining some of the elements, because olivine is there, and a lot of these things are nickel and iron and other types of precious stones. In fact, an interesting thing is, you know, there's tons of craters around the entire planet, and if you look at what's underneath those craters, oftentimes, and there's a big one in Russia, and they just found a load of diamonds. So anywhere it hits, there tends to be these gemstones because of the impact from these asteroid meteorites.
Well, isn't there moldavite in, is it Hungary that it is from a meteor? It's called moldavite.
Most likely, there's a lot of gemstones and very precious minerals. And in some cases, they're even thinking perhaps oil, because even the small one, if this one was to hit the planet, it will be the equivalent of a 50 megaton nuclear bomb. That much energy. The big one was like something like 100 megatons. That's even more than what we have in our whole arsenals on this planet. So you can see the amount of energy.
That they're saying on the news is that it could possibly hit a satellite that's actually...
Exactly. Because it's coming 17,200 miles from us. Our satellites go all the way, and there's tons of satellites, up to 35,000 miles.
Right.
So... And the space shuttle is much lower than that, like I said, about 250 miles, so they're not going to have any problem with the space shuttle. But, yeah, there's satellites from pretty much the space shuttle all the way up to 35,000 miles. So
if it hit a satellite, what would happen?
Well, I mean, things have hit the satellites before. In fact, two satellites actually hit each other sometime back. That's why we don't have the, I think it's called the Iridium, it was going to be the satellite cell phone. And that poor satellite got hit by a Russian satellite. So basically, you don't have satellite cell phones at this point. At that point, at least, I think we've gotten some new ones up there now. But you know, this happens. There's collisions from time to time, actually, satellites.
Let me just ask you both a question. And you know, I was listening to Coast to Coast the other night, and they say it's not if, it's when. At, you know, look at the moon. It's full of craters from, you know, asteroids hitting that. I mean, is there a possibility at some point in our future that, you know...
Well, you and I and Dr. Desiree were recently in the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan area that was formed some 65 million years ago. That it was so vast, it reached 110 miles or 180 kilometers really into the Gulf of Mexico, and you can see it from space, remote sensing technology. And we felt an enormous uniqueness of Mexico. Yucatan has a different type of soil structure. The whole reality of what that event took place in terms of human and animal evolution is, of course, under great debate, but Luis Alvarez and his son Walter here at Berkeley suggested that the dinosaurs were killed off. Mass extinction took place at this time, and we know that the Chicxulub area is significant because it marks the threshold of what could happen under the worst scenario.
But, you know, Dr. Hertak actually, of course, wrote the book The Keys of Enoch, and in what he was shown about our immediate future in the next at least 50 to 75 years, he did not see a major disaster equivalent to that taking place.
Right. And I believe we're coming into an awakening of human civilization. I think life on Earth is beautiful, and we are now at a moment where we're finally maturing as a civilization, and it's time to really enjoy ourselves. And we can always worry about the sun exploding or this or that, but we're here to really live, enjoy, and be the incarnation of the divine spirit that we are.
Well, that's exactly why we were in Yucatan recently, to celebrate with the natives of the Indian traditions, the indigenous people who have this marvelous tradition of fire coming out of space, the events that were there, and also that gave birth to forms of proto-astronomy and geology that created a great civilization, a great scientific civilization that really has answers and secrets to the planetary scientists of the past.
Right, and we just finished December 21st, 2012. We went through the end of the old era, and we're now in the new one. Let's not look at the disasters that will take place. Let's look at ways that we can help the planet. And there's much to do here, what's taking place all over the globe. So,
well, I do appreciate your work and your, you know, intense focus on keeping us aware of these spiritual realities and your work with the Keys of Enoch and the upcoming conferences and the movies you're involved with are adding to the upliftment and ascension of our planetary civilization. So I really appreciate the work you both are doing. Is there anything?
I just want to add a footnote to our earlier discussion, because we're talking about the width of our moon, and I had indicated 3 hours. I was referring to the period of observation between 19 and 2200 hours
Friday.
But the impact, should we say, and the speed of what we're seeing with the DA-14 would be 45 seconds approximately for crossing the space the size of a moon. So I wanted to make that clear. We're working at very quick events that possibly could be captured by those who have small cameras in that part of the world. But unfortunately, we're not going to see it from our side of the world. It's going to be there in Asia primarily.
And in Europe. So, yeah, look at an object that goes the width of the moon in 45 seconds that's traveling around Virgo and Leo constellations, and you may be able to see it with binoculars even, or even with the naked eye, depending on how clear it is.
Okay, so it will be like a kind of, like a plane jet, like what?
Just a round light, just a white light that's traveling, almost looks like a satellite because it's similar to that. And it's at 17,000 miles away, and it's, again, 45.7 meters wide, but it's quite far away. So,
thank you. And tell us, I mean, you'll be, of course, in and out of New York, but tell us what's coming up for both of you.
Again, the Ozark UFO Conference is coming up on April 12th to 14th. There'll be people like Linda Moulton Howe, Giorgio from Ancient Aliens, and many other people that are also lecturing there. So hopefully maybe some people who are interested in the UFO side of our work will be able to join us.
Okay. Well, I
appreciate that. So this is the age of the extraterrestrial imperative, and there will be disclosures, I believe, in Washington this year that will be very significant in tying together information that suggests we do need a new astronomy, a new cosmology, and we need to have really more information regarding the quote-unquote extraterrestrial anomalies that we're seeing, both from natural as well as what some would suggest as non-natural sources that we have to look at. We have to enlarge our cosmic roadmap, but we also have to realize that we are cosmic citizens growing up in a dynamic universe that is bio-friendly to us, that we have a place of destiny.
So we'll let you take off with your next guest on UFOs and realize that asteroids could have brought the primitive life here, although we think that perhaps all of us came from a higher perspective.
Well, I appreciate that. Is there anything, I'm going to be talking to Grant Cameron. Is there anything you know who he is? He has the UFO White House.
Right. Well, we're looking forward to much more disclosure this year and from many people, and hopefully in the next couple years that maybe now, or hopefully the government will be starting to release some of this information. It might take an event. It won't be an asteroid, but it might take a UFO event that everyone sees and no one can deny.
Do you want to stay on the line and talk? Have you any questions? I mean,
it might be an event like lightning striking, so we say the White House
or the
Dome or the Vatican.
Or the Vatican. What did you think of that? That was pretty strange, wasn't it?
I think this will be a slide to a new theology-astronomy. And astronomers will play a very important role in the disclosure events in the coming year or two. And I just say this in a sense of deep seriousness. There are tremendous theologians and anthropologists who are scholars looking at the whole roadmap of where we go from here with the new information.
Well, are you interested? I could bring this person in. Do you want to hang on a little bit while I and then you could just get off when
So we'll say a few words under the first.
Okay, let me just add Grant. Let me see. I just also want to make sure he's here, because if he's not answering, then we'll just continue our conversation. But I'll be talking to Grant Cameron, who's been studying UFOs, and his website is White House UFO, and I like his point of view because it's kind of coming from a place of consciousness. Hello, Grant. I don't know if he's answering. I might have to hang up and call him back.
Be honest,
can
your
we
time
carry
provides?
On, or do you have to get everyone off to do that?
Can you, what did you say?
Can we talk while you're hanging up and going?
You can keep talking. Let me see if he is.
Does that work for our...
Well, let me just say to our worldwide audience that we're looking not at firsthand knowledge, but we're looking at knowledge that has come as a result of field research that has been intensified after the time of Gene Shoemaker and his study with colleagues, you know, in terms of the, shall we say, the signatures of crater being formed.
But we can talk about life in the universe, and I think that that's so exciting because it is the essence. Al, what do you need to do to...
No, go ahead. Talk about life in the universe, and I'm going to try to reach him on this other line, so go ahead.
Okay, so what we want to say is, I know Alan, actually, we did a special video together, which is available on newrealities.com and also our website, which is keysofenoch.org, and it's called Consciousness and... well, the roads to consciousness. And what it talked about was the fact of this impact from meteors that allow the amino acids to come into this planetary system and grow life throughout the universe. And this could be the whole cause of panspermia around the universe. So UFOs are one thing, asteroids are another. This is so exciting.
What's the difference, I'm asking Desiree, between comets and meteorites? What's the difference between these celestial objects? Again, we're looking at meteors coming, falling to Earth, meteorite material passing from space. All of this coming really from the areas of the Oort cloud, what is called, that will still be there even after the collapse of Mother Earth. We're looking at other mechanisms that suggest that we live in a universe that is full of very, very important ingredients of life. In fact, the Kepler 32 has detected upwards of 100 billion planets plus with other research bases in the world. Right. And we're looking at a very rich Earth-like ocean of creation.
Right, but let's talk now because I know the new topic is going to be on extraterrestrial life in the universe.
And I'm bringing Grant Cameron into the conversation. I don't know if you know who he is. Let me see if he's answering now.
Yeah, I'm here now. Can you hear me?
Grant, yes, this is Alan Steinfeld. I'm on the phone. I'm on with Dr. J.J. Hertog and Desiree Hertog, and they've done. Do you know their work with UFOs and research?
Yes, I saw the lecture one time. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Okay, they were just kind of. Go ahead, Desiree. You were going to say something, and then I'll bring Grant into the conversation.
Just finalizing our talk, the conversation we were having about asteroids, we have on a film with you, Alan. It's called Consciousness and the Codes of Life in the Cosmos. And, of course, we were talking about asteroids bringing life, but we also can acknowledge that UFOs going all over the local star systems also could have brought life amongst the planets.
Right. That's true. I think where Grant is coming from, and you can correct me, is sort of the cover-up angle and the state. And what I really liked about a conversation I heard with you was the state of consciousness that you have to be in meeting these beings. Do you know what I mean, Grant?
Yeah, well, the consciousness, I sort of, I'm coming from the angle that... the UFO sightings really doesn't get us anywhere, that you have to start. I don't think ufology spent enough time getting into the sort of the talking to aliens consciousness, the sort of the non-physical aspect of it, which I think is where it's at. And I quote three very famous examples of the fact that the governments have known right from the word go that this mental part of the phenomena is very important. And the first was the Canadian memo in 1950, where they stated that the American officials had stated that mental phenomena was part of the whole problem. And then the former president of Penn State University, who came forward and in a UFO conversation, said, "Let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And unless you understand ESP and how it works, you will not be taken in." And then, of course, the famous statement made by Ben Rich when he made this famous speech in 1993, and he went out of the room, and these two UFO researcher engineers guys chased him into the parking lot and said, "How are UFOs propelled?" And he turned around and said, "You know, how does ESP work?" And they said, "It means all things of time. Time and space are connected," and he said that's how it works, and got in his car and drove away. So that's my angle on consciousness, is the fact that this, I think, is the key to the whole thing, to understanding what's going on.
I think you're right. Do you have a response with that, Dr. Sartak? Because you work with consciousness and the whole idea.
Yeah, I would definitely know from the work with Dr. Scott Jones and others who were formerly connected with Stanford Research Institute, that the study of UFOs went hand in hand with ESP studies and what people call a higher communication state of mind that would suggest that without one, you cannot understand the other. In fact, in our research in Russia and China with so-called experts who were involved in the Soviet space program, it was clear that the Russians were interested in the paraphysical phenomena and mind over matter studies, which such intensity as to say that they knew that the inner mind, the power of remote viewing, remote sensing, ESP had to be a way to put all of this together in a reasonable language of discourse.
Right. And so when you read about abductions, for example, there's a certain power of the mind that comes from these extraterrestrial beings. But if we're not even going to look at that realm of extraterrestrial phenomena, just when you talk to people who have had contact with some of these beings and flown, and some of them have, as you know, flown in their vehicles, they say that there's not a lot of buttons to push or knobs. It's really all controlled mainly by the mind, a little bit maybe by the hand pressures and gestures, but mostly from the mind.
Well, that's my... No, I just want to say that's my whole reason for wanting to talk to Grant, because I think he was onto something, because I don't think disclosure is going to happen in the way we think it's going to happen, because these beings, according to what I feel, are not really part of our reality. They're not in the same mental space that we humans inhabit, and we have to somehow shift an awareness in order to meet them on another plane or another level of existence. What do you think about that, Grant?
Yeah, I agree. I think if you take a look at the whole phenomena and this sort of this mind thing, you can see that we've been working on this for many years, ESP experiments and all sorts of remote viewing stuff. But if you take a look at the aliens, you can see if what people are reporting is correct, that there is no noise. And one of the big objections I've always gotten for people when you're talking about this thing about talking with aliens or interacting with aliens is like there's so much noise, you can't do anything. But if you take a look at the reports by abductees or people like that, there is no noise. These people have this down to a fine science where it's completely signal and no noise. And I think we can learn by going into those various aspects of looking at that. And if you look at the work the CIA has done, I say it's they call it phenomenology, that if you take a look at ESP, remote viewing, telekinesis, UFOs, there's an underlying principle that we don't understand that sort of explains them all.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that I think, or if you look at John Alexander's site, he calls it UFOs phenomenology. And if you Chase Brandon, this CIA guy that came out last year, he's talking, and all of a sudden he calls it phenomenology. So I think that in the intelligence community, they know this connection, that it's all one. It's all one thing. It's not hard nuts and bolts ufology. It's something beyond that, and you have to look at all of it And I think we can learn an awful lot if we take a look at all these different types of phenomena and assume that there's something underlying these things that we're smart. I mean, we're not stupid. We can figure this out.
Well, that's why I like Dr. Hertog's work, because it involves altered states or higher states of consciousness. So you were saying, Dr. Hertog, JJ.
Well, I would say that you can also go to this website of Paul H. Smith. He's involved with not only the powers of the mind, but also the defensive strategy built around remote viewing, remote sensing, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, I completely agree with what has been said.
Right, and we worked with J. Allen Hynek years and years ago. Of course, he was one of the first top researchers, and it was always a shock to him. He would go to these encounters, whether it's Pascagoula, Mississippi, or places in Brazil, and, you know, it wasn't nuts and bolts, and that's what maybe people who haven't studied deeply the UFO phenomena don't understand. You know, they're looking for the vehicle and they're looking for how it crashed or something like that. But these beings actually have a way, and they're more advanced than us. Let's all face it. And we don't think they're necessarily more spiritually advanced, even more, we'll say, higher consciousness advanced, but their minds, their ability to think, to move, to do things are more advanced than we are. And that's really, I think we're evolving into that state as well as we move into that.
I think most of us walk around in a pretty unconscious state of awareness anyway. And what I was saying about Dr. Hertog's experience, you know about his experience, Grant, where he was actually taken up to another level of reality. And I would say your thinking actually changed. Would you agree with that, Dr. Hertog?
Absolutely. This is why I had to break formally with the scientific community to pursue this sort of as an independent approach to looking at the fieldwork that would be necessary behind the information that was downloaded in that experience that I had. But again, I'm saying this out of respect for our worldwide audience. What we need to have is more tools of interpretation of data. We have literally cartloads of information from various resources, NICAP, all of these groups that have collected information for more than 65, 70 years.
MUFON.
We need a better set of, shall we say, interpretive tools, and that comes from the realm of consciousness that our guest is pointing at, that I completely agree with.
Well, what are you doing about that, Grant? I mean, you have these three pieces of evidence, but how are you working with that, with the UFO research community, and showing people there's more to the phenomena?
Yeah, I've sort of since I had this sort of this epiphany last year when I got this idea at the conference in Phoenix, I've actually interacted a fair bit with the consciousness community. They've sort of found me, and I think to me that would be one of the things is to get the consciousness community together with the UFO community and to run some studies. And I've sort of found, for example, in the last maybe 3 months, I've come across five people who have a lot of money. And there's never been any money in ufology, but these are people who I've interacted at length with two of them. And there's a third one I'm having a meeting with in Phoenix. And they're all into ufology, but they're not into sightings, stuff like that. They're into this thing of chasing around contactees, of they've had experiences, and I can see this sort of shift taking place that the people that are seriously looking at this are looking at this aspect. I think there is a change taking place, and you can even look at Bob Bigelow, who's the billionaire guy who's, you know, very interested in UFOs his whole life. He put up the money for MUFON to do the UFO research. There was a rumored story that he was, you know, talking to abductees. And I know back in the 60s that Bob Wood, who was working with Douglas Aircraft at the time, they did a study, a UFO study that they spent $500,000 on. And in that one, they were talking to abductees too. And I sort of noticed lately that these business people, and if you take a look at Bigelow, he put up $3.7 million to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and it was called the Bigelow Chair for Consciousness Studies. And Bigelow had this NIDS group, which was sort of like a UFO think tank, where he'd bought the best UFO minds, brought them in, got their advice, and I think he understands the connection between consciousness and UFOs, and I think that's the way we got to go. And I'm just trying to get some people inspired to do some sort of test, because I think if you look at near-death studies, the stuff, there's all these similarities that if we can get some studies done on this, I think we'll start to make some moves instead of just going for sightings, because the best you're ever going to do with a sighting or with a UFO photograph is an unknown. You cannot get anything past an unknown, and I think that's the next step. And I've seen these big money people that have moved into ufology, and I think we're making the move there.
Well, Jacques Vallée always, probably from the beginning, insisted that it was more than just a physical phenomenon. So did Carl Jung, although Carl Jung said there was basically all psychological, but there's obviously a lot of components to UFOs. There is a physical element, but it's also something much more.
Almost all of them are not just three and even fourth dimensional, but they move into the fifth dimension. And this was a shock, really. Yeah, Jacques Vallée worked very close with J. Allen Hynek in the 70s and 80s. And this was the real strange thing. And many people in MUFON didn't want to look. They were just wanting to look at the nuts and bolts. But the fact that these beings can go through walls, the fact that they can actually paralyze people or give them information in different ways, that we, you know, it's almost all telepathic. They see things. It's a whole image and picture. It's actually working in pictographs, as Dr. Hertak calls it, instead of words. I think we're moving a little bit into that. I'm still very positive about trying to be more sensitized to the way these other aliens also operate.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I think the important point Grant is making, is that we can approach ufology in the ways that it's been approached for the last, 50 years. First of all, we need to understand more about what consciousness is, what everyday consciousness is, and then we can start to move into other realms of awareness.
Well, this is why Senator Claiborne Pell, wanted to bring together, as Grant had suggested years ago, ufology with the paranormal aspects of consciousness expansion, and that was the basis of the first disclosure releases in Washington, D.C. in May of 1995. Dr. Scott Jones, Dr. John Mack from Harvard University, and I participated in that, and we looked at the aspects of parapsychology and that the contactees all were involved with consciousness expansion, intercommunication, telepathic information that would span the gamut of information. But essentially, that was an earlier wave that the press was not interested. The people who were the traditional ufologists were not interested, as Desiree just said. They were only preoccupied with the nuts and bolts rather than those who, through higher states of consciousness, could see the other connectivenesses that we had with other evolutionary streams.
Well, right, but also Grant's also been involved with, and maybe you could talk about this a little bit, how presidents of the United States have some way or another interacted with the UFO lore that we've had for the last maybe even 100 years. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Grant?
You mean what, in terms of UFOs or consciousness? Because I know...
Well, yeah. UFOs and consciousness, yeah.
Yeah, see, I think they understand that as well. I mean, he's getting, the best material from the intelligence communities. And I know Jimmy Carter, for example, one of the things I was sort of puzzled with when I was going after UFOs in the presidential libraries is there really is nothing there. But I was sort of felt a little better when I tried to find Jimmy Carter on remote viewing, because I talked to help. Put off and Hal Putoff assured me that they were briefed. And so if you look in the presidential libraries, there's no documents on UFOs, but there's also no documents on remote viewing and this sort of stuff. And if you read Jimmy Carter's latest book, his diary, you'll see he talks about remote viewing and being briefed on it and saying it was one of the most spectacular things he'd seen in his presidency. And it was, beyond belief, but it was for real, that he was amazed by this. So I think they've got a handle on it. And I know the presidents were briefed on this, and I just think that at that very high level, the people that are briefing the president, I think they've known. If you go back to 1950, where the Canadian government in a top secret memo referred to the fact that the Americans had told them that mental phenomena was possibly part of the flying saucer phenomena, it's critically important, because that was maybe almost 16 years before the first Betty and Barney Hill book was published. That was 2 years before the first contactees made the appearance. So they knew before anybody ever started talking about talking to aliens or anything like that, that this was an important part of the phenomena. And, of course, if you go back to the Canadian government thing, the Canadian government guy that was running the Flying Saucer program was in contact with aliens. I mean, this was sort of an everyday thing.
What was the Canadian guy's name?
That was Wilbert Smith.
He was
dealing with the Canadian government. He was dealing with the Prime Minister, and he just saw it as he was always sort of written off later as being sort of a nutcase because he believed in this thing that you could actually try to communicate with these. He called them the boys' top side. But then if you take a look, the fact that right from the word go, when he first started, that he was told by the Americans that this is an important part, which sort of opened it up to him that he figured that this is something you have to work on. And in the UFO community, it's sort of been rejected, which is too bad. We're still going down the old thing where we rehash the same 12 UFO cases on all documentaries, and we want to call for another study and say, you know, let's do another study. This will solve it. I say if you have another study, it's going to be the same as the first study. It's going to be 12,000 sightings. It's going to be 701 unknowns, and you're going to ask everybody, what is it? And they're going to say, we don't know. You have to make the next step. You have to make this move to looking at these items that Dr. Hertak is talking about, and a lot of people, Scott Jones, and there's been a lot of people. It's just nobody's really taken it serious and tried to push that as an area of research. It's sort of been set up.
I remember looking at one of the declassified reports where Jimmy Carter actually said he saw a UFO, and then it was later countermanded by saying he saw Venus. This was supposed to have been released in 1977, and I was on a television program speaking for the Carter position, hoping that year would see more evidence and action in the presidential community. But as we know, what happened was the same old story.
So we agree with you, Grant, as you mentioned, as you know. But one of the things that is key to lend to this support is that many people have really had, we'll say, close encounters, at least of the second kind or the third kind. It changes and shifts their consciousness. They're totally different people, and I think that that's the key. And when you talk about what is consciousness, I know Alan agrees with us that consciousness is not localized in the brain. Consciousness is part of a field. And when you link with those other entities, we were talking about the asteroid coming by from, you know, out there in space. We're in a certain sense, this planet is linking with that energy. When you link with an alien intelligence, you're starting to encounter and be part of that alien intelligence in some way.
Right.
So this is something.
I think that's true. I think an encounter with these beings shifts you permanently. It alters your state. That's why I don't think they just appear like we're sitting in a room or you're sitting in a room. They wouldn't just appear. You also have to be in a sort of altered state or in a dream state to actually meet the presence of these beings, or if you do meet them, you are immediately shifted. And I think that's actually what's so traumatizing to many people who have these encounters, these abduction encounters. It's not that you meet them, it's that our reality is totally distorted. And anybody who's reported these abductions have talked about the distortion in the reality. And it's just a matter of our consciousness shifting.
So, yeah, and I have to just add to clarify for 1 minute that we believe that there's different levels of intelligence. So the ones that picked up Betty and Barney Hill were probably just people who wanted to do experiments and they saw, you know, different ethnic groups and they wanted to see them. Then there's those that are much more, we'll say, kind of spiritually intelligent, helping people. And
yeah, but I don't think it's that simple, Desiree. I don't think it's like they just, I think what human consciousness was capable of knowing was only what Betty and Barney Hill were able to describe, but that doesn't mean that's all.
No, no, I'm
just saying the aliens were about, you know.
There's different beings. There's different beings. Yeah. Some are really part of a larger program, and some are just trying to. But at any encounter, regardless of who they are, shifts the consciousness.
Right, but I don't know if we can really say what any of these encounters have been about. I mean, what do you think, Grant? I mean, you've looked into it. Do you think we know at all about anything that's happened with these aliens? Is it possible?
Well, as Desiree is pointing out, I mean, I agree that there are many more different types of aliens than the ones that we sort of know is that, like the Greys, because they've sort of really interacted and sort of made themselves identified. I was just talking to the guy that was collecting all the encounters with aliens, and there's like 17,000 encounters.
There was
a book written. His name escapes me. It's a Spanish name.
Yes. Antonio Hanias, probably from Chile.
No, it wasn't Antonio.
7,000 encounters of Earth and you, alien beings.
Yeah, and it's sort of a lot of it is grays. And I said, well, separate the grays. How many without the grays? And he said, that's not been done. But if you remember back, I've been in this since the 70s. There's a book called The Humanoids back then. And it was basically all these different types of aliens that were being described. That's another thing that sort of ufology has. We've got one position that there's no contact going on, that the aliens, if they want to make contact, are going to land on the White House lawn. And so we got that. And then we got the other one that says it's just us and the grays, which I think is wrong as well, that there are all these others. And so we have one position that everybody in the 1950s, up until Betty and Barney Hill came along, were lying. They're all deceived. They're lying. They're crazy. Anybody that said they were talking to a humanoid type, just an ordinary alien that looked like us, it was all made up in the 50s. Not until 1966, until Betty and Barney Hill's book was released, did people start telling the truth. And I disagree with that. The other thing that I'm bringing up now that I've started to look at is that a lot of what is happening, the aliens are very much in charge. We think that this is happening randomly. For example, like the grays, we think that a person gets abducted and then suddenly the amnesia starts to break down. And then these people start looking for a psychologist or somebody to regress them to get them out of this high stress level that they're in. And if you take a look, I have a quote from Barbara Lamb, who's done 1,000 regressions of people that are involved with the grays. And she talks very specifically about the fact that when she was being trained for other type of hypnosis, this is in the late 80s, that she was told that the girl was giving the lecture, and she said, and you may run into at some time in your career people who claim that they've been picked up by aliens, and you should be aware of this just in case it happens. And Barbara Lamb said in her head there was a booming voice that said, Barbara, listen carefully to this. This you're going to be involved in. Now, she's done 1,000 regressions. Before she did the first regression, in her head, she was told, you're going to be doing this, which gives the indication, and I have other examples, that the aliens are basically in control of the whole thing, that the idea that the amnesia is breaking down, it's like they're telling Barbara Lamb, get ready, we're about to send you some people, and this is this sort of the way the aliens are dropping this out.
Do you mean the gray? Which set of aliens you think are doing that?
Well, the grays for the abductee, like most of hers, although she talks, again, I was trying to get out of people like her and other people who are doing regressions, are they all grays? It seemed to me very strange that you have all these different aliens, and yet you only have the grays that are sort of behind this abduction type phenomena. But in terms of her, she basically had this thing, and the thing that inspired me on this consciousness thing was this idea that Colin Andrews, who was the top crop circle guy in the world, and as you know, he was funded by Rockefeller, and he came up with this report, and they had private investigators chasing around people who were hoaxing circles and stuff. And I got this sort of epiphany when he gave this lecture last year where he said 80% are hoaxed, 20% are real, like alien caused. But then he came up and said he now thinks that the 80% that are hoaxed are also controlled by the aliens, that the aliens are telling the people that are hoaxing the circles what to create. And he produced some evidence, and it sounded pretty impressive type evidence to back up this theory. And so you come up with this theory that what we sort of think is going on, that it might all be, we're just a bunch of puppets, and the aliens are controlling the whole thing, our reality of the whole thing, how this thing's going to unfold. It's almost like we're reading a book and the aliens are turning the pages, because if you look back in ufology, what you will see, I've been in it long enough to know, it has not always been uniform. From 47 to 52, there was no sort of people saying there was encounters. You had all these landing traces where they were landing and leaving the pods. Those things don't happen anymore. Crop circles only started in the 1980s. Cattle mutilations only started in the 1960s. It is not a uniform phenomenon. If you go back to the 70s, it was a completely different world. We talked about different things. There was no talk about crashes, no talk about bodies. There was no talk about crop circles.
Well, it's a whole different thing now. We're not talking so much about abductions. There's probably less and less people being abducted. And now the conversation is this conversation about consciousness. So maybe you're right. Maybe the aliens, whoever they are are kind of unfolding a scenario that we're just kind of acting out. I mean, I know Dr. J.J. Hertog has talked about many different types of aliens.
Yeah, I'd like to defer to Desiree. She's got...
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that I agree that with Dr. Hertog that there are different types of aliens, and there certainly is a gray alien agenda. There's no doubt about that. It seems to be oftentimes connected with the abduction phenomena and things like that. I want to say just something that talks about consciousness, and this could, you know, people can put it away and say, oh, it's just one little episode and it's not real, as many people do. But there was an encounter in the Bermuda Triangle with some associates of mine with, we'll say, beings that look like us. We call them the Adamic species. Some people call them Aryan race. Well, just different aliens, but they were clearly alien technology. And they were told not to say too much about this phenomena and certain things that they were told. And we were sitting around in a room.
Years later.
And especially a friend of mine who's
a lawyer
who really knows how to get stuff out of people. He's still a lawyer. He's a fantastic lawyer. And he started asking and really drilling this girl. And she started talking. And all of a sudden, it was his kitchen. A shelf that had been like really nailed into the wall flew up. Now, not even down. It didn't fall down. It flew up. And items came out of it right when she was starting to say too much. So the idea is, they are constantly, in some ways, in touch with our consciousness reality, no matter where we are.
But who are they? They're not just the grays, or maybe the grays are working in concert with a gray. I mean, if it is all consciousness, then obviously what the grays are doing are known by other groups of aliens as well.
Exactly. And the grays may use the implants to code and encode some of the consciousness, where other beings might be able to use more of a direct consciousness link. I'm not, you know, these are little things that one could talk about and do analysis on. But I agree with Grant that we've got to see that these beings are much more empowered. I don't think they're taking over the planet, but I do think that they're, according to John Mack, there was tons of people that are actually were abducted by gray intelligences.
So I wanted to say this also in respect to what Grant said earlier, that Colin Andrews has come up with a book called Government Circles, and I think if you in the radio audience worldwide get a chance to put your hands on this book, you'll begin to see who are some of the shapers and movers on the edge of a new reality. We are in a competition between different levels of advanced intelligence and neighboring intelligence that wishes to, shall we say, see how far the human experiment can be pushed, either to be subordinated to other agendas or to come alive and break free of traditional scripting, realizing that we are cosmic citizens and we have every right to know who are the movers and shakers behind the scenes, including those in high places.
And to be in charge of our own thoughts and our own plans.
Right, right. But I really liked what Grant laid out, is that there's sort of been a style or evolution, like in we had Roswell, and in the 50s, who was that guy who used to take people out to UFO Rock in California?
George Van Tassel.
George Van Tassel, and the other guy, Adamski. Adamski, and no one really, and so Adamski was sort of made into sort of a hoax. Maybe he was or maybe he wasn't, and they talked about Venusian, people from Venus. And then with Benny and Barney Hill, the whole topic evolved to another level, which was a sort of frightening, scary abduction level. And there's sort of been these like waves and this kind of style or this evolution of consciousness in a sense that's gone along with ufology. And so I think we're in a new phase, but Grant, where do you think we're going with this? I mean, I liked how you laid it out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think there's a movement, and there's this sort of Dr. Hertog can maybe explain it better. Is this idea that when you get enough minds on the same wavelength, that it causes its own sort of reality, and that we're getting pretty close to sort of the tipping point where we're gonna start down this road where consciousness is going to be taken seriously. I'm actually surprised just in the last year. And maybe it just I wasn't aware of the stuff that's going on, but I've been kind of amazed that that there is people there, and there's still this sort of breakdown in terms of the consciousness. It's almost like the sci-fi and the UFO people don't get along, and the same with the consciousness people and the UFO people, where they're each doing their own separate thing. But in the last year, I've seen it going across, and I think that you take a look at the work that Edgar Mitchell is doing on consciousness and the relationship to UFOs. And he's talking very positively as well, that this, they're getting a better understanding of how consciousness fits into the whole scenario and the zero point energy and stuff. And I think it's moving along. I think we're actually on the right track, and it's just a matter of time for everybody else to catch up.
Exactly. And we've put out a new film with one of our associates called Wisdom of the Wayshores, where Edgar Mitchell does speak about the very things that you have pointed to. And those in the listening audience may be aware that our Academy for Future Science does work with some of the best minds in the area of feature film documentary research, also with some of the top geologists and archaeologists and space scientists of the world. So this would be a good thing to put on your shopping list, Wisdom of the Wayshores. The Keys of Enoch, launched in 1973, outlined basically a blueprint of consciousness expansion. And this is a critical moment that we're entering at present time, to see a need for a multidisciplinary approach, where once a hand doesn't negate the other, one part of the brain doesn't, should we neutralize the other, we need to come forward across the board from the standpoint of what is going on in neurology, biology, as well as evolutionary biology.
Right, so basically the Keys of Enoch in 73, which is when it came out and Dr. Adak had his experience, said the same thing we're saying today, is the fact that we are being prepared for meeting these beings on higher levels. So, you know, exactly. If we were even to meet in the 60s or 50s, I mean, if people were talking about beings around Phoenix, I mean, they didn't even understand that it could have been some vast star system of the Pleiades or Orion. So we're growing into that, and we're really just about ready, I think, for our own global close encounter.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Edgar Mitchell, because he's really the person who brought the idea of consciousness into a public conversation.
You know what, Noetics Institute, which is a term for Noetics, which means that it's a variation of consciousness or gnosis, higher knowledge, which requires experiential levels of being able to not only see experience, but also to digest, take in new information that allows one to expand one's birthright. So,
and of course, he was one of the astronauts that just didn't walk on the moon. He probably went the furthest you could on the moon. He told me he hiked around the moon for a couple of hours. And
I was working with two of his colleagues who were the biological targets on Earth that he was communicating with. When he shut off the NASA apparatus and began to use mental signals to send geometric and mathematical numbers back to two human counterparts on the planet. And he was able to upstage, shall we say, high command at NASA headquarters, as well as a fair amount of scientists here in Silicon Valley who were amazed that one of his background could really show that there was a different level of proto-communication built into the human mind and built into the human psyche. So we're really talking about a roadmap we all share, and we're thankful that you, Alan, have made this a wonderful dialogue amongst all of us.
Right. Well, I'm happy to do that. You know, Grant has a whole UFO White House website where you trace the history of presidential contact. You know, one of the things I'm interested in is what Nixon showed Jackie Gleason, which was a real craft there. You want to talk about some of those early cases with some of the presidents, Grant, and what they may have been, aware of?
Well, I think the one that you're talking about, Nixon, is the one where he takes Jackie Gleason to Homestead Air Force Base and shows him the bodies, because he had his Southern White House there, and Gleason lived on just south of Miami on a golf course. And so there's that. The one that I'm kind of interested in now, the other thing I've sort of gotten into was the whole idea that the government is sort of leading us down the path. You have the aliens doing their sort of gradual disclosure and leading us along the path, and so is the government. And one of the things that I'm thoroughly convinced of now is that in the 1970s, there was a documentary called UFOs Past, Present, and Future that was greenlighted by Richard Nixon. And this provided a lot of material that was used. It was a actual film contract signed with these two guys in Los Angeles, and a lot of material that they got was clearly new material, and it included even the story about 1959 where the CIA is channeling an alien at the National Photographic Interpretation Center in Washington, D.C., and the UFO flies by the window. They're interacting with this alien, and this is a story that Art Lundahl, who was the won the National Security Award for the CIA, he was a very high level guy, supposedly the guy that briefed the president on UFOs. He actually told this story, and it wouldn't go on camera. And they used the Air Force, the former head of Blue Book, to go on there, but. This is the kind of story that interests me, is where you get Nixon actually writing a letter to Bob Emeniger at the end and saying, thank you for your cooperation on the project we worked on. And then in 1983, this Bob Emeniger guy and Alan Sandler, who owned the studio, get contacted again during the Reagan administration, and they're taken back to Norton Air Force Base where they keep all the military film. And they're told, we like the documentary. The government liked the documentary you did in the 1970s. We'd like you to do another one. And Emeniger's saying, well, is Reagan behind this? And really didn't get a clear answer. And you have these stories of this stuff being dropped, the documentary, TV documentary, two-hour TV documentary in October of 1988 called UFOs UFO Cover-Up Live. Absolutely no doubt about it. Was a CIA operation. There was all the CIA people that were involved. They had a meeting at the CIA headquarters the day after the documentary to discuss what had happened there. And so you see this pattern that the government is through the president is greenlighting this stuff, but there are this gradual disclosure of protecting the classified material that they want, like the how the thing flies, the mental phenomena type stuff that the intelligence community can use. But the actual story, the government, I am thoroughly convinced, is gradually leaking the core story of what happened and maintaining the classified aspects that they need.
Well, I heard that Nixon was forced out of office, forced to resign because he was going to come forward revealing the UFO cover-up and that there were aliens here. Have you ever heard that story?
I haven't heard that story.
I can say the day that he made his statement, he was about to say it there on the microphone. He was countermanded by his security advisor. I also can say that I do know the nephew of Rod Serling, and Rod Serling was to be the spokesperson for this film report that Robert Emeniger and other associates were to release. So everything that Grant has said is correct, as far as I can tell by my research.
Well, Nixon probably knew about it because of the Eisenhower meeting. Do you believe Eisenhower actually made a deal with the aliens as sort of part of the ufology lore that people are talking about?
I spin it different. I think that, again, if you look back in the 1950s, we sort of take today's ufology and we sort of impress it upon the 1950s. In the 1950s, I don't care what anybody says. There were no grace. It was not talked about. There was no discussion. When Eisenhower had this supposed meeting at Edwards Air Force Base in February of 1954, the discussion was human type aliens, looked like us, the blondes, whatever you want to call them, the Nordics, whatever. This was the discussion. The discussion of grays did not start till 1966. So people are now trying to take the grays and making this the grays. If the grays are not going to make a treaty, if they're going to abduct people, there's nothing the government can do now to stop it. They don't need a treaty. They just abduct people. And they're not going to give the American government, this is a theory, they're not going to give the American government technology, which with the American government can shoot them down with. This is a nonsensical thing that's sort of come up. When I wrote an article, if you go to my website, presidentialufo.com, in the Eisenhower section, I talk about this, and I talk about all the things that were happening at the same time, and the fact that if there was a meeting, it had to do with nuclear weapons, because the message that's been given to contactees, abductees now today, is this environmental message that there's this disaster taking place. All the messages of the contactees during the 1950s were dealing with nuclear weapons. And if you take a look when that meeting took place in February, a couple of days later, the Americans detonated the first Castle Bravo, the Bravo tests. And Castle Bravo was detonated only days after that meeting, supposed meeting with the aliens. And it was the one where they had the thermonuclear weapon, and it was supposed to be 5 megatons. And they had this tritium-7 they thought was neutral, and it wasn't neutral. And the thing turned out it was 15 megatons. It was the biggest nuclear explosion. They wiped out 3 islands. They had to pull the people off the islands. They had to evacuate the guys 20 miles away who had detonated the test. It was the biggest contamination, nuclear contamination thing that happened until you get to Chernobyl. It was an absolute disaster. So if there was a meeting with the aliens were there to warn them about nuclear weapons, and Eisenhower just ignored it, and a couple days later they run this test that just goes haywire. So
do you think the meeting actually happened? I mean, you've looked at the material. Do you think that's logical or makes sense?
I know for a fact, because I went to the Eisenhower Library, went through everything, all the everything that had to do with that Palm Springs visit.
Yeah,
for sure, the president disappeared, because they had to call the press secretary back at late at night, because one reporter had put on the wire that the president had died of a heart attack. They knew something had happened. He was gone, and the press secretary James Haggerty had to come back and calm the press down and make up this story about the. So it definitely. There was something did happen. He did disappear because the press picked up on it. What people don't know is the fact that the Canadians had this Wilbur Smith guy, and this is a documented case, because the Secretary of Defense stood up and talked about it in 1967. 1954, exactly the same year, the Canadians opened up what is our equivalent of our Area 51, which was called Suffield. It was an army base in Alberta, and they opened up the base for UFOs to land. And when Paul Hillary made this speech in 67, I went after him, and other people went after him, and I said, well, how did the aliens know where to land? And I went and I talked to Wilbur Smith's wife. He had died, and she told me, yes, Wilbur had contact with aliens, with the alien by the name of Alpha. He had got the government to agree that they would not shoot the thing down. So the government is on the record that they opened this base for UFOs to land, and they say, well, nothing landed, therefore UFOs don't exist. The part of the story they don't tell is that they wouldn't give a 100% guarantee they're allowed to take off, and Wilbur called the whole thing off, but it was he who convinced the Canadian government. The same as in Great Britain in 1954, you have this story, and the guy's name escapes me. He came out and wrote a book years later. He was the guy that controlled the nuclear weapons in 1954, and he tells this encounter about this alien that comes to him and wants to talk to the Prince Philip. And he's talking to this alien, and the alien is talking about the nuclear weapons, and you guys are out of control and stuff. And he writes this up in his autobiography years later, that he had an encounter. So 54, you had all these encounters. And the other thing you have at the same time as this Eisenhower story is you have a story that only David Rudiak and I think have actually researched and pushed, and it has not gotten into the consciousness of UFO researchers, is that there was 2 satellites that were detected in 1954. The American government admitted that these were satellites. They said they'd been captured by the Earth's magnetic field, and it was in Aviation Week. It was in a lot of different New York Times picked up the story. Everybody picked up the story. The same woman that was involved in this channeling incident in 1959 with the CIA was saying that these were alien spacecraft. And so this was happening at the same time, and there was a story that happened at a Chicago radio station where they made communication. They said, we're going to make communication with this, these 2 satellites. And they left the air opened for 15 seconds. The aliens are supposed to put this message. There was four people who claimed they got messages, and the two were these Meyer sisters in North Chicago. And if you read the 1997 CIA report on UFOs, you'll see them talk about how the CIA tried to recover the message that these two women had got from these two satellites, and that they had dressed up guys in Air Force uniforms because they weren't involved in UFOs. And it went right up to the director, where the director got involved trying to cover the fact that they were trying to recover this tape message that these women had recovered. So there are all these contact stories.
Colin Andrews also talks about a television broadcast where the aliens came on in England and did a message to people, like an interrupted a television show. Do you know about that one?
We were
in Mexico City on the 26th of November, 1977, and I was interviewed by Novedades, which is like the New York Times, about signs of extraterrestrial involvement. And I said we would have some evidence of this, and the time was short to live together in peace. I was not aware of this, but approximately the same time over in UK, in Greater London at 5:05 p.m. on the 26th of November, there was an intercept that took place over British broadcasting systems. The ET source said the time was short to live together in peace, put away your weapons of war. And so I later shared this with Colin Andrews, that there was the ingredients of a message both in London as well as what we felt in Mexico City, because there had been a landing that had taken place. I was asked by representatives of the president of Mexico to give an interpretation of what was there. A UFO craft had landed in Mexico, and I had passed on to the president that Mexico, that military force should not be used against this unusual event.
But I agree, and before we sign off, that the whole thing with the nuclear weapons that we did in New Mexico, and of course you have the Roswell incident very close to that period of time, and you have many sightings across the northern part into Canada of where military bases that had nuclear missiles in silos, of course, were completely neutralized and shut down, and you even have one event in Bentwaters, England, the same thing, where you could only control the missiles and turn them off from the lower bases, and yet by a UFO flying overhead, where people reported and saw it, they were also completely shut down. So there's clearly a warning, especially in the, we'll say, the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and into the 70s, that this is part of the message that they were trying to give to planet Earth.
Well, so, yeah, you bring up this thing about the weapons. I'd like to make a point here, because you bring up this thing about the weapons along the Canadian-American border. My first sighting took place 2 weeks after the end of the Vietnam War, and I really didn't know what it caused. There was a town just north of the border where I live, and there was sightings, just piles of them, in 1975. And I went to the guy who was the main guy in the town that run the airport that was involved in this. I said, "Bob, why were they here? This little town, it meant nothing." He said, "Well, you know why they're here." I said, "No, I don't know, Bob. I have no idea why they're here. 30 years, I have no idea why these things were showing up in this town." He said, "The missile silos." And I said, "Oh, shoot." And the key part is that this gets into this consciousness thing, that what I think happened is, if you remember back again, you got to look at the time when it happened, not now. In 1975, this was the domino theory. This was the thing that China had fallen in, and then in 1975, South Korea falls. Then the domino theory was that the communism was going to take over the world. It'd be South Korea, then to Philippines and stuff. And all along the Canadian-U.S. border in 1975, the end of the Vietnam War, all the missiles were Loring Air Force Base, Wirthworth, where I was at Grand Forks, all the missiles there, that the aliens were interacting there as if they could pick up on the consciousness of the American government that was saying, we're going to make a take a stand, we may have to use nuclear weapons, and they picked up on this, the same as Rendlesham Forest you mentioned. Rendlesham Forest was December of 1980. All the forward nuclear weapons that would be used at the Soviet border for small skirmishes along the Soviet border in December 1980, Solidarity had taken over Poland, and they wanted to separate. And December of 1980, the Russians moved all their tanks to the Polish border, and they were trying to decide at that point, would they reinvade and take over Poland again? And that's exactly when Bentwaters, and that was the forward nuclear weapons, and suddenly it was almost like there was a consciousness, are we going to use these nuclear weapons to stop Russia from going into Poland. The aliens pick it up and appear at Rendlesham Forest and play around with the nuclear weapons. I think that's where this idea of consciousness fits in, that they seem to know what we're thinking. They can tap into this, and they show up at the right times and the right places.
Well, I totally agree, and that's why I think people talk about negative aliens or bad, but I think they are for us. They see us as a part of the universal biology, and we're an aspect of them in terms of consciousness. So I think there aren't the negative ETs. I mean, there may be abductions, but we don't really know what that's about. I think it's really all been for our evolution and the evolution of life in the universe in general, the whole interaction. So
very well said. We need to put together, as it were, a new textbook of the different evolutionary life forms. Again, there's such a wide variation, as we have found out in our field research in many countries throughout the world. Unfortunately, the nuances differ between anthropologists, culture historians, and trained scientists involved in the planetary sciences. But we need to have a new vocabulary.
And also analyze these events, because chances are that the beings that were neutralizing the nuclear weapons that we were just talking about, they also seem to have spin-off like light vehicles that came off of their vehicle, and their vehicle wasn't even three-dimensional or fourth-dimensional. Someone could put their hand right, they could see it, but put their hand through it. So these are not necessarily the grays, and I think we have to have a differentiation between the different levels of intelligence that are here.
But my idea is, I don't think we really know who the grays are. They may actually be robots or aspects of a higher intelligent beings. I think there's not the clear division we'd like to make, like among people, this is this tribe, that's that tribe. I think there's more of a fluid movement among these alien races. I don't think we can make this is just my idea or guess. I don't think we can make the same distinctions.
And you're still getting, whether it's the grays or whether it's any other alien, you're still getting the same message. And the one example, I'm doing a consciousness lecture in Phoenix in a couple of weeks, and I bring up the story about the 62 school kids in Rhodesia who saw the alien running around underneath the spaceship, and they got these messages, which a lot of people don't know. These little kids got the messages, and it was the same environmental message. One kid thought the world was going to end, the trees were all going to die, there would be no air to breathe, and they were getting these messages, and John Mack was interviewing them and saying to them, well, how did you get this message? And the kid said, it just popped into my head. And the other girl said, it was in the eyes. The message just came through in the eyes. And this was not a gray. This was a little fat guy dressed in black that had long black hair and looked like a hippie. So whether you have grays or any other, the message is basically still the same, I think.
And Cynthia Hine in Rhodesia at that time had the kids draw pictures of this. So I was with John Mack, and we had researched these children that saw the beings even floating in position. So,
and also small spheres of light. So it's similar to
we had similar
seeing
situations outside of Mexico City, and a few years later, where school kids also saw these spherical objects with smaller, satellite spheres appear with these strange life forms, an event so powerful that it requires, as it were, a whole new psychology, a whole new anthropology to realize that the children may be more open to these unusual areas of new evolutionary evidence.
Alan, in closing for us, because I know you've gone over your time.
Oh, that's okay. But anyway,
our website is peaceofenoch.org, and we have a few DVDs that you share and we share together, again, for people who are interested in the consciousness and the codes of life, and some other ones that perhaps we'll be working on as well together.
Well, let me just ask you too, before you go, and I'll continue with Grant, but let me just ask you, in terms of consciousness, our evolution must include this interaction. We need to know more about who we really are, in terms of like what you call the overself, in order to interact with these beings. Can you just end on that note and tell us what you think about that?
Yes, we as a human race are waking up to the fact that we have great resources built into us in terms of consciousness expansion, the ability to go beyond the traditional three-dimensional scripting that we have, and recognizing that we can only reach out to other life forms in the universe, but actually at some point in our future development, join with them and co-participate with them in redefining civilization as Homo Galacticus. I think this is a very exciting point of time. It requires really a whole new type of networking of information. I really salute Grant for his wonderful work, and I regard him as an inner player of knowing the authentic history of what has taken place, why there are those in the political establishment and those who are interested in geopolitics to cover up these events that would deny us the tools of free energy, the opportunities to work with other avenues of expression, navigation, and ultimately a type of time travel experience whereby we would recognize that we are, by definition of being galactic humans, also given, as it were, permission to participate with these cosmic cultures. So we know there are cosmic others. We know the time is being collapsed in terms of the old scripting that we have to either look backwards at old political scenarios that will not work out, or we work with a whole new criteria of inventiveness, energy, and friendship. And on this basis, we must build this worldwide academy or university of knowledge without walls to prepare for future civilization.
And prepare that we are no longer earthbound, because that's our true inheritance, that's our true identity.
So we will be releasing more film studies from our field research throughout the world in Africa with John Mack that we did back in the 80s and 90s. Also work that we've done in Brazil, work that we've done in the Philippines, in Japan, and also our new book, The Overself Awakening, is recommended for those who are interested in the parapsychology, the psychology, and what could be called the metapsychology of consciousness, of waking up to the fact that we are, by definition, beings of light in the human experience.
Well, thank you. Desiree, any final words?
No, that's, we just want to share with you in the future, hopefully, Alan, and more information, of course, about our future in both consciousness realms and also extrasolar.
And we'd like to keep in touch with Grant. Grant, by the way, the other counterpart of AFA was OZA. So this was one of the other entities that was in correspondence with some of our sensitive individuals who were aware of the science behind the scenes taking place. And also salutation to the family of Wilbur Beadle Smith, who was one of the best researchers and authentic spokesperson for the real story taking place in Canada that sent waves of information to wake up the sleepy intelligence here in the United States.
Well said. I'm very encouraged when I hear you guys talking about this. I think we're making some headway here. I'm very encouraged with this conversation.
Well, we're going to sign off. Say love to all our friends throughout the world. Godspeed again to you, Alan, for providing this forum for this wonderful update.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I'll be in touch. Grant, do you have another half hour to talk?
Sure.
Okay, good. Thank you, Dr. J.J. Hertog, Dr. Desiree Hertog, and the work of the Academy for Future Science. I'll be doing more shows with them in the next couple of weeks.
Wonderful.
Yeah, good. No, they're good friends of mine, and I like their perspective, and their point of view is from a place of consciousness and bringing what this phenomena is all about in terms of who we are as human beings. And I think that's really why I was so drawn to what you were saying. We have to redefine who we think we are.
Yeah.
And then we can start to meet these beings on their terms, because they're not going to come down to our level. We're very primitive on our mental abilities to understand reality. We're not more than the animals. That's what I think. But we have the capacity to be great, aware beings on many levels of consciousness. So I think what the ETs on whatever level, if we call them grays or Nordics, they are waking us up to this other level of who we are. I mean, John Mack said that the UFO is a sign for the universe for the consciously impaired, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And it, even myself, a prime example, I mean, a year ago, I would have thought this was totally nutty conversation, and I had this enlightenment experience when I saw Colin Andrews give this lecture on the circles, and it was like suddenly I go, oh, that's what everybody's talking about. It made sense, and suddenly I just sort of said, like, you know, this is where it's at. I mean, this is because you can get very frustrated. I don't know yeah. your position, but in ufology or even in these areas, I mean, you can get very frustrated. You're going like, what's the point? I mean, this is crazy. We're not getting anywhere. We're just spinning our wheels. We're doing the same thing over again. And when I saw this, I mean, all this stuff popped into my head, and it was like, oh, okay, now it's like I'm inspired, and then all these things started to happen where I ran into the consciousness community, started to interact with them and these business people, and it was you get this synchronicity type stuff that starts to happen, and you figure like I'm on the right track here. So I think whether it's the aliens that are behind it, which I think they're doing an end run. And I think the CIA has even admitted that. If you know the whole story about Dr. Ronald Pandolfi, who was identified by the New York Times in 1996 as the top scientist in the CIA, he's putting some of his material. He's the guy who was involved with Gordon Novell. Novell claimed that he was backing him for 5 years. He had made a statement to Dan Smith, who he puts most of his stuff through, that they had determined that they weren't able to control the UFO phenomena, so what they've done is they're following the UFO researchers and what's happening, conversations and what people are doing and theories and stuff like that, because they really can't control the UFO
situation. So they might
situation.
Be listening to this conversation you're saying.
Well, I'm sure they tap into everything to find out. I was on an interview just when this book was released, and I was on the one radio show, and the producer had sent a message that there were 6 people who had just logged on from the CIA. I think they're very conscious of what's going on in the UFO community, trying to figure out, number one, is there something that they can use? Because they're working on this problem. It's either you figure out consciousness and you figure out this mind control aspects where, I mean, you take a look at this technology that the Greys exhibit. And I mean, do you want to give this to Al Qaeda, where you can actually go and get the president of the United States, go in there, grab the guy without the guy even knowing that he's being grabbed, get into his head, make him passive, give him messages, make him think that this is happening, put screen images in his mind? I mean, this kind of technology is what they're really sort of dying to get a hold of. And you have that aspect of what they're looking for, and you also have the other aspect of trying to sort of move it along and sort of get this gradual disclosures. I think they're quite interested in finding out what we're doing, and this other aspect of getting the message out. So well, so sure, they watch.
They watch, and if we talk about in terms of consciousness, it does get into this, what I feel and what the kind of core of this program is about a spiritual awakening. And you can't talk about consciousness and perception and levels of awareness without knowing that we're more than just physical beings.
Yeah, and I think there's some pretty simple experiments that show it's almost like ufology. When I see these experiments, and I sort of think, well, how can science not buy into this? It's like this sort of non-locality, this idea about the two particles that, you know, that are entangled, where you get them and you do something to the one and the other one immediately reacts no matter where it is in time and space. And this is basically like ESP for electrons. And science sort of admits, yeah, this entanglement exists. But if you take a look at ESP, transfer of knowledge between people, this is nuts. But it's the same thing. All it is on one level it's electrons, and the other level it's human beings. Right. And you can see stuff like the guy before Pandolfi, this CIA guy, the guy before him was Kit Green. And he's now running an experiment with a guy from China, and I haven't determined whether they've actually run the experiment. But this is to see where their minds are entangled. And what they're going to do is they're going to get two people, a sender and a receiver, and do a telepathy type experiments with MRIs, and they're going to watch the brains as these signals are sent, and to see whether they get a message at exactly the same time in both brains to show that minds are entangled.
Well, that, so Dean Radin did that. He proved that minds are entangled. You could tell when someone's looking at you. Rupert Sheldrake's done those experiments.
Yeah. Sure, Sheldrake even did the one that the other second one I bring. You bring the electrons, and then Sheldrake brings the amazing one about the rats. The rats at Harvard University, where they're putting them through a water maze, and after 15 years, the rats are instead of making 200 mistakes per test, they're making 20 mistakes per test. So they're learning, and of course, then they come up with the theory that, oh, this is genetic memory, that the DNA is storing this and stuff. And then you get these scientists in Australia who decide, oh, we're going to reproduce the Harvard rats, and they're rats aren't related. It's the same breed of rat, but it's not related to the Harvard rats. And they run it, and it runs even faster than the Harvard rats at the end of the experiment, which seems to indicate that there's a field, and these the minds of the rats are picking up information from these fields, and they're actually learned what the Harvard rats had learned and actually had advanced beyond that. So you get this kind of stuff where you look at these experiments that have been run over and over again that simply show that consciousness is a field, that people, the brain is nothing more than a sender and a receiver that's tapping into this consciousness field, the same as a TV picks up a signal. It doesn't mean that there's a little guy inside the TV. It just means it's picking up a signal that's out there. And I think science, it's getting close. I mean, because these experiments are there, and it's quite clear. And that's where you get, like, the whole thing. If you take the particle thing, you affect one, and the other one is, it becomes aware. Awareness is consciousness.
Right.
So you get the thing is, if you change the particle and just do July 1945, an atomic bomb, and that happens, is the universe aware? Well, sure, the universe is aware. The universe is aware that you've done this because of this field, this consciousness field. And, of course, that's when the UFOs all appear in mass, after we detonate the first atomic bomb. If you take a look at it in that way, and those simple things of consciousness, it really starts to make sense. Oh, now I can understand what's going on here.
Right. So in terms of consciousness and evolution and field effects, I think we're at a critical point where we understand that there are aliens. We've seen enough alien movies. We know what an alien's like. They're almost integrated into our field of awareness. And I think it might be something like that for a disclosure or a contact situation to take place. Because I think they haven't shown up, this is just my opinion, because they didn't want to freak us out. You know, because when a greater civilization meets a lower civilization, they prove this in anthropological studies, the lower developed civilization freaks out. They have more suicide. So I think this is a gradual awakening and contact that we are coming into, and maybe sure, they are working with the government.
I mean, they would have learned that you can't do this. I mean, that's where people get the idea that they're going to land on the White House lawn. And I say that's our sort of idea of how we would do it. And as I always make this thing, some people get offended. It's like, you know, we're going to take a lower civilization and we're going to go there and bring them freedom, democracy, Jesus, and McDonald's and all these aspects. And that's how we would do it. We'd go and announce ourselves. And what you take a look at, you take a look at the UFO evidence, I think you see this gradual thing where they, for example, they use screen imaging. When somebody's taken on board, you'll see dead people there, like dead relatives and stuff. And it sort of calms the person down. The same as if you look at, I do a sort of a study in this lecture I'm doing where I show the similarities between near-death studies and UFO abductions, and it's unbelievable. It's the same thing. In when a person dies, there's usually someone that comes to greet them. So if you assume that reincarnation is right, say your father comes to get you. Mm-hmm. Well, your father will appear as your father, but it's a spirit type thing. It can't be your father. It can't be a physical father. Mm-hmm. It's got to be a screen image. He's lived 100 different lives, and he will appear to you as the father, knowing that that will calm you down. And the aliens are using the same sort of thing. And there's just really, really bizarre things. When you look at alien abduction and near-death studies, even down to the thing about some of the aliens wear medals. And this doesn't make any sense. I mean, they've got a medal on.
A medal from like a war, you're saying?
Yeah, sort of like a medal, like a ribbon and then some sort of medallion that's on them. Like, why would an alien have a medallion? And if you look at, I don't know if you're familiar with the Life Between Life study, Dr. Michael Newton, the 7,000 cases. Now they've got all these students. They're probably up to 10,000 cases. And they describe quite clearly the fact that when you die and you go to this life review, that the people on the dais, the three to 12 people who are doing the life review, the advanced beings, all have these medals on. And that they have this strange writing around the outside of the medal. And all these people report this. And you get people on abductions, and they're describing medals, and they're describing this strange light, this strange writing around it. Or you take the thing about, if you take a look at the description of the aliens having this crystal, that they have a crystal and they have a book that is a three-dimensional image that you can look at it and they can take you back in time. And this was in this 1988 documentary, this UFOs Cover Up Live documentary, where they talked about this aliens having this crystal. And if you go to page 93 of Journey of Souls, that talks about this life between lives, you can read about the crystal. The same thing, that the people that have these near-death experiences or life between life experiences will describe this crystal, the book that has the three-dimensional images in it, and the aliens are describing the same thing. You have these people come back and they have inventions, people who can suddenly can do things that they never were able to do, or people who completely change, suddenly come back and they're doing art and they've never drawn in their life, and they're suddenly painting, and you get so many similarities, which to me means that it's the same field. It's the same sort of, whether the aliens are taking you into this spiritual thing, that the same thing that occurs when you die or what it is. But there is this definitely a lot of similarities. Just, it's amazing how many similarities are.
Is that a book did you write that book, a book comparing the two?
No, this is in a lecture. I've put this together in my lecture. As I work through this, I've done this lecture three times, this consciousness lecture. And every time I sort of advance the lecture, it's only the last year. I used to be a nuts and bolts guy that thought, you know, like you got to get to the hardware, you got to get the government documents, you got to get the intelligence connections and figure out what they know and force this out, and it's all nuts and bolts. I never saw the connection to consciousness until a year ago. So then I moved across, and now I've, in this third generation of this lecture, I'm looking at, because before I got into UFOs, I got into UFOs at the end of the Vietnam War with all these experiences just by the minute three missile man silos. And so I before that, I had was at university and I was taking near-death studies, and I'd done a paper where I went to hospitals, and what I was asking chaplains, I didn't go to doctors or nurses, I went just to chaplains, because the chaplains are really the ones that are there when the people die, and there's no games played. And so I was asking all these weird questions, like, did you ever have a person get up when they're near death, right at death, and they get up and there's a miracle? Have you ever seen somebody predict their own death? Anybody ever see somebody come to visit them before they die? Near-death experiences. I was doing all these weird things that surround death. And it was there that I sort of picked up this sort of idea that, you know, that there was this connection, there was a spiritual thing. But it really didn't hit me until last year, when suddenly all that came back and I went, whoa, you know, this all makes sense. This is all – it just all – almost the way Edgar Mitchell describes this experience coming back from the moon, where suddenly it was like, you know – Paul on the road to Damascus. There's just everything just flowed into my head. It happened in seconds, where all this material came out. And now, as I've sort of gone through it, and like your guest tonight, or people I see more and more all the time, that there are people who are on this, and I'm busy working as hard as I can to put that material together. But there is a definite connection between near-death experiences and the abduction experience.
Well, have you looked at Rick Strassman's studies with high levels of, was it DMT, that being produced, abduction studies? I mean, they've had abduction-related experiences on DMT without the abduction going on, yet some people claim to have experienced that just in the room with the heavy dose of DMT. Have you heard about that?
No, no.
Oh, you should look into that. Very interesting. Yeah. DMT is the active ingredient in lots of psychotropic drugs, or especially ayahuasca and some other ones. And people,
but again, there is that causing you to go into this sort of altered state?
Yes, I mean, of course. You go into this altered state, and you,
sure.
have a simulated sort of abduction type experience,
or you enter that state. It's the old argument about crazy people that hear people talking to them. Are they crazy, or are people actually talking in their head?
Right, right.
I mean, maybe you just move into that state where you enter it through whatever means you're using, and so that's where I think you can learn from all these different things. That you look at the similarities and you start to say, like, well, I think we can figure this out. I think we can actually recreate the state, or we can figure out what's causing the state, or what's the underlying. To me, it's always the important thing is the underlying thing, the rule of nature that we're missing. Like electronics, like, you know, electricity 500 years ago, nobody knew what was going on. Didn't mean there wasn't a law there. It's just we didn't understand it yet. And I think that's where we are with this, is that, and I think consciousness is the answer, but we have to understand how it works. And once we understand how the thing works, then we can make great advances in spiritual and, you know, exploration and understanding, you know, where we're coming from, where we're going, all that sort of stuff.
Well, no, I think you're putting a lot together. I mean, as far as, these altered states, near-death experiences, you're definitely in an altered state of awareness, and same as the abductions and also this DMT experience. And perhaps what I think is those levels of reality are always happening to us, except when we have these heightened states of awareness, we start to realize that, hey, this is happening. So
yeah.
That's
yeah, we've just got it turned off, yeah.
Yeah, we have it turned off because we've been so conditioned into thinking this reality is all there is, you know, this kind of very flat three-dimensional world. And we've shut off the parts of our brain that are aware of these other levels. But if you take a hallucinogenic substance or go to on one of these experiences, you realize that we're so much more expanded. There's so much more to the human being. And I think this is where ufology, and I like where you're going, has to go, because nothing else seems to have worked. You know,
yeah.
the government hasn't come clean with it. And, because I think they don't understand it themselves. You know,
yeah,
did you ever listen to Dan Barish and his telecommunications with the aliens that he talks about? What do you think about that?
I don't know. I mean, it's like, it's so bizarre. I really just sort of dropped it, the same as a lot of people, and just said, you know, I really don't know if this is for real. Because that's the part of the problem, is that the stuff that's coming out, I don't really think there really are any government sort of people who are leaking stuff. If you take a look at this guy today, this police guy, I mean, how long did it take to find this guy? I mean, it took a couple of days. In ufology, we sort of believe that there are people like whistleblowers who come out and they can call themselves Mr. X and they can run around and say all this kind of stuff, and the government's not going to do anything. I'm absolutely convinced that if it's classified material, whether you're the president of the United States or a scientist working someplace, they're going to get you. You can't release. So I think that what a lot of this stuff is stuff that's clouded with disinformation. That you spin it, there's some truth in it, whether it's the Serpo stuff, whether it's the stuff that Novell was bringing out, or all this sort of stuff, that there's a core element of truth in it, but there's so much stuff that's put around it to protect it, because you have to protect the cover-up. That's always the bottom line, is that once you spill the milk, you can't put it back in the glass.
So and will there ever be a time when the milk will be spilled?
No.
Not going to happen.
No, not that they're intending to. There was a time. There's a story told in 1991 where they just about under Bush pulled the plug. August of 1991, they were going to do a disclosure thing. This is just after the Soviet Union had fallen, and that thing fell through. But you see, the problem is, it's always the classified aspects of the thing. Is that the way they have it now works quite well? Is that if you're looking at weapons technology, that if you suddenly say this is for real, like some people say, you can say the president can stand up and say UFOs are real, but we're not going to talk about the rest. We're not going to talk about the classified aspect.
Right.
Isn't going to happen, because people are going to ask questions. Everybody's going to assume, well, now we can come and talk. So what they want is the everybody in the world, whether it's the Russians, Al Qaeda, China, they want everybody to think this is crazy. So they won't work on it, because the American military doesn't understand 100% of it yet. So you want everybody else to think it's crazy while you're working on it, because right. when it comes to military, it comes down to lead time, that it wars take like days now. So if you develop the technology and then have to use it, the other side, if it takes them 50 years to develop the technology, the war is over in 2 days. It's game over. So just the idea that you know something that the other side doesn't know, that's reality, is very powerful stuff. So that the military, I don't think, will ever give up on it, because then suddenly the Chinese are going to say, oh, this is for real. UFOs is real and consciousness is involved. Suddenly everybody's going to be working on it. And if you don't have all the answers, somebody may beat you to the final answer. So you want to play this game like there's nothing going on. And yet you want people to be at a situation where they're not back in 1947. And Kit Green, before Ronald Pandolfi, who you know, before Ronald Pandolfi was Kit Green. This is in the 70s and 80s. He was a neuroscientist, analyst for the CIA, ran the UFO files. And he talks about this. There was a group of guys who came over and did a book. It was called The Mirage Men. And it's a book that they had written, and the basic premise of the book was that all the UFO stuff, everything that's happened, is all disinformation, counterintelligence from the U.S. government. It's all a big game. There's really no truth to it. And they interviewed Kit Green. And the interviewer, when they interviewed Kit Green, the guy said he actually started to sweat. He couldn't believe it, because Kit Green is saying, no, this is for real. And he's going like, what do you mean for real? This is supposed to be disinformation. And Kit Green to him, and in this new book that I just released, I quote Kit Green on this. And Kit Green says, if you're the government, what are you going to do? If you've got this problem, you got to put yourself in the position of the government. What are you going to do? And so one of the theories is that you sort of drop all this stuff. The aliens are eating our kids. You know, they're going to take over the world and all this crazy stuff. And then if you suddenly can't control the cover-up, something happens and it breaks, then the story is ETs are here. Nothing's bad. They're just here visiting. And everybody goes, what? That's it? I mean, there's not eating our kids. And they go, well, what's the big deal? So you hype them up, and then when it comes out, it's way below what anybody thought it was, and people are acclimatized. They're ready to do it. And there's so many examples of the government acclimatizing people to this phenomenon. It's unbelievable.
What's some of the examples that the government has?
Well, the 56, Walt Disney was asked to do a UFO documentary, and he had worked for the FBI. He had done a lot of film stuff for the U.S. government during World War II, training films, stuff like that. Was very sort of inside government guy, and he was asked to do a UFO documentary. This is one of the nine animators who told the story. Kimball was his name, and he was really into UFOs. He told this story at one of the UFO conferences, and so they said, well, we're going to give you all these film, and we're going to at the end of the thing, you can put the film in. So Disney did the film. He got like 90% into the film. And then suddenly they said, oh, the time isn't right. We can't give you the film. And Disney finished the UFO documentary. So he releases this UFO documentary to acclimatize the people, but he's not allowed to use the film, because the whole thing is you can talk about it. You and I can talk about it. They love when we talk about it, as long as you don't have the classified. As long as you don't have the classified film to stick in there, then everything's okay. The prime example is the story that Dr. Hertak and I were talking about, this Bob Emenager. And this is a story, if you realize how this whole thing unfolds, that things have happened in patterns. 1969, the U.S. government gets out of UFOs. They shut down Blue Book, which is the official U.S. Air Force project. And it's game over. They say, there's nothing to it. We're shutting down the program. So at that point, as I've always said, they could sit there and watch NFL football and Dancing with the Stars from here to eternity. And that's what the Canadians did. The Canadians shut their program down at exactly the same time. And the Canadians, I lived in Canada. I've been in this UFO business for 40 years. I could not tell you what the Canadians, who's in charge, whether they're involved in UFOs, have no idea, because they've never talked about it. So the American government is out of it.
Even the guy who came forward, Hellyer, wouldn't he know? He has some inside information.
No, he said quite clearly he was the Minister of Defense, and he didn't pay any attention to it and really didn't know anything. He just and when I asked him about because he's the one that revealed the fact that the Canadians in 1954 had opened the UFO-based this place for UFOs to land, and I went after him, I and another researcher, and I said, well, who gave you this? I mean, how did you know this? And he said, well, there was a guy who was an expert on UFOs inside the Department of Defense. I can't remember the guy's name. He gave it to me. The speech was written for me. I don't even remember giving a speech because what had happened, it was a Centennial Project, and what he was doing is opening a UFO landing base, like one of these little Centennial Projects in a town where they make this, you know, little landing base for a tourist attraction, stuff like that. And he had opened this base, and that's when he told this story about 1954. So he maintains even today, I don't know where the stuff came from. The speech is written for me. I just read the speech. So he really didn't know anything at all. So the Canadians didn't know anything. And so you have in 1969, the American government gets out of it. They don't ever have to talk about UFOs again. 2 years later, 1972, and this is how Bob Enring tells me the story. He says, my wife's into this UFO stuff. I think this is absolute nonsense. She's reading this tabloid newspapers, the aliens, somebody had an alien kid, and he says, and he would say, Margaret, can you quit with that nonsense? And suddenly, Alan Sandler, he's an advertising executive for Gray Advertising, and his partner is Alan Sandler, who owns the film studio in Los Angeles. And so they make films and commercials and stuff there. So Alan says, we've got to do some documentaries for the American government. So they go to Norton Air Force Base where they store all the film, the Defense Audiovisual Agency at Norton Air Force Base. This is 1972. And they're taken into a CIA clean room, which is electronically screened and stuff. They're inside the CIA clean room where they film CIA training films. And the guy says, we want you to do these documentaries for the government. We're going to do holography and working with dolphins and all these different things about the U.S. military that will put us in a better light in the public's eyes. And then at the very end, this guy who was the security manager for all the films says, oh, and we'd also like you to do a UFO documentary, but we'd like you to hide it under all the other documentaries that you're going to do. What would you think if we told you that at 6 o'clock in the morning in May of 1971, a UFO landed at Haldeman Air Force Base, the aliens got out, were greeted by high-ranking officials, and that we had filmed the film, we had filmed it from three different, the U.S. Air Force had filmed it from three different angles. And Bob's going like, this is crazy. My wife is talking about this. Now suddenly they're telling me this stuff is for real. And they were given the film. They had it in their possession. They had this Haldeman landing film in their possession. Now, they didn't see it, but the security manager actually went on film and described what was on this thing about the alien getting out and all this sort of stuff.
Wait, it was in their possession, but they never saw the footage?
He hesitates. When you ask him, did you ever see the film, he hesitates. Bob hesitates, and then he says no, which so it seems to indicate they may have seen frames of the film. Mm-hmm. But in the end, they're allowed to put 8 seconds of the film in it. So there's 8 seconds, and if you see the documentary, you can actually see they're showing the hills at Haldeman Air Force Base, and all of a sudden you can definitely see there's this UFO, and it breaks. The film breaks, and you can see this 8 seconds. So I went to Bob, and I said, Bob, you told me to pull the film back. At the very end, they said, no, it's the Nixon's in trouble. It's Watergate. We can't allow the film to come out. And they pull the film back. And it's moved back from Los Angeles to the Pentagon. And then they put the 8 seconds of film. So I said to Bob, well, I thought they pulled the film back. Why would they let you use 8 seconds of film? And he said, well, it was just for background. I said, well, what do you mean for background? He said, well, it really didn't show. It didn't show the aliens. And it didn't show the craft. And so it comes down to this classified thing that they put it in there, but the classified aspect is what did the alien look like? The classified aspect is what did the saucer look like? You're not showing anything that's really going to upset the apple cart. And so they do this, and they talk about the fact they go to the Pentagon. They're doing this. They go to the Pentagon. They walk into the Pentagon. They don't sign in, nothing. Just walk right in the door, and they're escorted to the E-ring where all the powerful people are. Everywhere they go, people are told to do describe what they're doing. He talks about going to DARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency, and he talks. This is 1972. If you're talking about consciousness, 1972. He goes into a room. There's this big, huge, like you know, big computers in the day. It took up half the room. The other guy's sitting on the other side of the room, and the guy says to him, the major says, "Okay, tell him what you're doing." And the guy says, "No, I this is classified. I can't talk about it. Can't describe." He said, "No, you have permission. Tell them what you're doing." And he said, "Well, I'm thinking of words, and the computer's telling me what the words are." And he said, "Well, try whatever the word. I can't remember the word was chalkboard or something." And the computer goes chalkboard, And they were up to 7 to 10 words. That this person sitting on the other side of the room would just think of the word, and in 1972, this computer could pick up what that person was thinking. So they do this documentary, and then in the end, the film gets pulled back. They do this story.
What was the name of the documentary?
It was called UFOs Past, Present, and Future in 1975. And then they redid it with Rod Serling as a narrator in 1979. They did it again. And this is the one that has the head of Blue Book in this room in Washington, D.C., where they talk about channeling this alien, an alien flying by the window. The head of Blue Book is telling the story on camera. And all this stuff is basically for real. They were given legitimate stuff. In fact, as I've made in a number of interviews in the last year, I've described the fact that they had another film. They were given NASA film. They were given all this sort of stuff. And the one film they had was a film of a launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base that went out over the Pacific. And these two UFOs were tracking this on the long-range camera, were tracking this missile and were flying around this missile. And I said, well, why did you put that in the film? He said, no, we didn't put it in the film. We just figured it wasn't right. We had it analyzed by these experts. And I said, well, did you give the film back? And he said, no, I don't think so. I think Alan still got that one. I said, you still got it? And he said, yeah, it was a top secret film. It had Quentin Ellis' name on the canister. And yes, I think we still have it. So this is the thing. Like, they were actually given the material. So you can confirm there that
they have the material now. And why can't you go and look at it, get it?
See, well, I was working with a girl, a partner, and they said if the girl comes down there, they'll show her the film. It's in Oregon. I guess if I went there, I could get it. I think they may be doing a project now where they may show the film, but it's in their possession. I mean, it's on the other side of the country, so
that's not a big deal. I mean, if it's really what you say it is, it would be worth going across the country.
But if you can use it, I mean, for me to see it, I believe they've got the film. But the key part of this whole thing is the government is out of the UFO business in 1969. Now, people will say, whether it's Burrish or Gordon Novell or all these stories of people coming out, they say, oh, it's just disinformation. The government's just playing with people, just trying to throw you off. And the whole point is they didn't have to throw anybody off in 1972. Maybe today there's people coming out with stories and they want to throw people off. But why, if you're out of the UFO business and you never have to talk about UFOs again, would you go in 1972 and pour gas all over it and start the whole fire going again? It was a public relations nightmare in the 1960s. They hated it. They had to put – every time there's a UFO sighting, they had to put an Air Force officer out. You had to make some stupid explanation of what this was. They looked stupid. They hated this. It was wasting their time. They finally got out of this PR nightmare. They got out of the UFO business. In 1972, they go and start it all over again. And they've been doing it over and over again since then. In fact,
what do you think is really going on? I mean,
I think they're basically – trying to disclose the UFO story without actually releasing the classified material. And that's how you and I met when I wrote you about this POTUS briefing. Yes. And I talk about in this latest book, I talk about this thing, and you interviewed Gordon Novell, and he had this POTUS briefing, and he's showing you this thing. And part of it was written by Richard Dolan, part of it was written by Jim Mars, and he had put it out, and everybody basically sort of poo-pooed the thing because it was Gordon Novell. Well, it's Gordon Novell putting this stuff out. This is, you know, really doesn't mean anything. And to me, it really had nothing to do with Gordon Novell. He was just a minor player. The fact is that on the front cover of that POTUS briefing, which he showed you in the interview, it had as the advisor Ronald Pendolfi, and it had the CIA stamp on it and the White House stamp. And Ronald Pendolfi, if his name is on it, and they're putting this out there, this is a guy who is a very high – he's the top scientist in the CIA. He worked for the Director of National Intelligence. He was moved to the White House in 2009 for a year. I mean, this is a high-level CIA guy.
But I thought about that pamphlet that Novell had. I thought, well, who knows? Anyone could have made that pamphlet and put the CIA stamp on it. I wasn't sure.
Okay, but if you're Ronald Pendolfi and you're this high-level guy in this very secret organization, would you allow Robert – Novell to be running around the country showing people a script with your name? You'd grab him and say, get my name off that script, because that's what it was. It was a script that was supposedly they were going to try to push to Spielberg.
Right.
And then the main guy that leaks the stuff on friends with Ronald Pandolfi, Dan Smith indicates that Pandolfi met with Spielberg twice. And the whole thing was Pandolfi behind Robert Novell? And I say, yes, he was, because I know a story that because Bob Emmenegger, the guy who had done this UFO documentary in 1972 or 1975, he really is not interested in UFOs. He hates UFOs, and his wife still talks about when I go to see him. He really doesn't want to talk. He wants to watch the Comedy Channel. He's really not interested in UFOs. And I'm talking to him one time, and suddenly he says, oh, I got a phone call from Ronald Pandolfi. And I said, you got a phone call from Ronald Pandolfi? Why would Ronald Pandolfi be calling you? You have not been involved in UFOs for 30 years. You're not interested in UFOs. And he said, well, Novell contacted me, and Novell wanted me to do some public relations stuff for this POTUS briefing thing that they're doing and stuff like that. And I looked at it, and I wasn't too impressed with it. And I said, yeah, okay. And he said, well, Ronald Pandolfi has to vet you before we can use you. And then Ronald Pandolfi phoned him, which backs up the fact that Ronald Pandolfi was backing Gordon Novell at whatever level, and that he agreed to have his name on the front of that POTUS briefing and was pushing the thing. Now, he didn't realize that Novell would maybe show it on your video.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't realize that I would get a copy of this, and now I've put it on the internet, and basically we've got the whole thing. So that's
that
the whole
copy of what Novell had, the whole pamphlet?
That script, yeah. It was actually a script, yeah. And we have the whole thing now, yeah.
But was it anything interesting, and do you think Pandolfi really actually acknowledged his name on that to begin with?
Oh, I would say he would. I mean, I definitely think he would have to have put his name on it, because his name was on it when you saw it, and I picked it up later. That there's no way if you're Novell, you're not going to like put, you know, President Obama's name on there and claim that Obama is behind this thing, because it's easy to check out. And, you know, especially a top CIA guy, you're going to haul him in. If he's has any contact with Pandolfi at all, Pandolfi is going to say, get my name off that script. What are you crazy? You can work in the background if you're a CIA, work behind the scenes, but to have your name on the front cover of this thing basically says that Pandolfi was part of this sort of disclosure thing. And I've heard last June, Stephen Greer had meetings on this new documentary he's coming out. He met with Ronald Pandolfi. So Pandolfi, as much as people, he may want to deny it or no, I can't prove it, is interacting with people in the UFO community, and he considers most of us to be very naive. We don't understand the national security implications. We're a bunch of flakes, and looks down on everybody inside the UFO community. But still, he is in it, and if he's in it, then he is part of the government. He is the government, and he's involved, and he's doing it for a reason, which I don't think is just to throw us all off, that they have some plan behind the scenes, which I think is similar to this documentary thing that Bob Emmenegger did, and, you know, Chase Brandon coming out, and there's piles of these stories where they're trying to get this out without upsetting the glass of milk.
Well, so what's Pandolfi's position now in the government? Does he have an official title?
He's back with the CIA. Nobody really knows. I mean, that's the thing. His position is so secret that you don't even know what his job is. So why would he allow his name on the front cover of this thing? I mean, he's got some sort of position inside the CIA. But the main thing I always quote is the fact that the New York Times, he was involved in 1996 with discovering that the Chinese were getting classified material on avionics from different aerospace companies, and he did the study, and then Congress found out about it, and of course they went after Bill Clinton, and Pandolfi was brought up in front of Congress, and there was this big scandal about this guy had reported this, and that was when the New York Times identified him as the top scientist in the CIA, which if he was top scientist in 1996, he's at least probably the top scientist now. He's a high-level guy inside the CIA when it comes to science.
Mm. Well, yeah, I wanted to ask you about Clinton, because there's that video of Clinton speaking at some conference, and he said he went to investigate the UFO story, and he sent someone to Area 51, and they came back, and they said, oh, there's nothing going on there. Now, did he really believe that guy, whoever he sent, got the true story, or was Clinton in on it from, you know, the beginning, you know, as a president?
Well, that's of course is the $64,000 question, which I give a lecture on either position. The president knows I can give you a lecture. Then he knows, give you a lecture the president doesn't know. I think Clinton would have had to have known. I mean, there are people who said that he was briefed at Los Alamos on two occasions, and I can't remember the date was 93 and 94 or something like that. The thing that sort of indicates to me that, that the president does know is Barack Obama went to Roswell last year when he was campaigning, and he gave the big speech. And when you go to Roswell to do a speech, every president does. They always make some sort of little joke, UFO joke at the beginning of the thing. Like when Bush was there, he said, "Oh, I hear you saw an unidentified object this morning. Don't worry, that was just me." So they always make some sort of joke. And the joke that Obama used when he was there, this is about 7-8 months ago, he said, you know, the questions that's asked to me most by little 9- and 10-year-old kids is, "Mr. President, have you ever been to Roswell? Can you tell us what's for real? Is it for real?" Mm-hmm. And he says to the little kids, "You know, if I told you the answer about Roswell, I'd have to kill you." And he says, you see the little kids, their eyes get all big. And then, so that's a joke, and everybody laughs. And then he pauses, and you can tell, I've seen enough presidential speeches that I know it wasn't in the speech. He pauses after the joke, and then he says, "We'll keep our secrets here." And Obama has always been considered to be like the real left-wing sort of guy. Military doesn't trust him. And that's was one of the rumored stories, was that the Republicans are told, and the Democrats aren't told. So Obama is probably the most left-leaning president that's ever existed. I mean, if he, by this indication of this statement, knows what's going on, then they all know. And I think part of the thing about the president doesn't know is just sort of a plausible deniability thing. So the question isn't put to him. I think he's basically told the basic, the basis of it. And then what happens is, if something happens, then they'll brief you. And it's the same with every other subject. That the president, people think the president knows everything. The president knows nothing. I mean, most of them were governors of states. They know nothing about foreign intelligence. They know nothing about foreign politics. They really, really know nothing. They come in on popularity and stuff like that. So basically they are trained by the people that they trust. And if something comes up, if there's a discussion about whatever it is, nuclear weapons or something, the president doesn't know about nuclear weapons. So if they know a question's coming up, they'll brief the president and say, "Okay, there's going to be a question today about nuclear weapons. This is the situation." And they tell the guy, and this is what the answer is, and that's how it works. Wait, so,
but what about that Hillary and Bill Clinton meeting with Rockefeller? Was it Lawrence Rockefeller that they met? And she was
It was Lawrence Rockefeller. What happened was the Rockefeller. It didn't matter who won, whether it was Perot or whether it was Clinton and whoever the other was, Bush Senior.
Yeah.
That they were. He wanted to go in, and he wanted it. He wanted the UFO stuff to be released. So he went in there, and
Lawrence Rockefeller, you're talking about.
Lawrence Rockefeller went into the White House, and he was cut off at the pass by the science advisor. You can't get right to the president. So the science advisor was dealing with him, and they sort of played around with him. And then Rockefeller got a little upset, and he said, "Well, you know, if I really don't get what I need here, what I'm going to do is run a full-page ad in all the major newspapers in the United States asking for UFO disclosure." And then they went, "Oh, hang on. And they tried to do what they could to satisfy him. And what happened was, during this whole thing, he was writing a letter to the president on UFO disclosure. He wasn't dealing with the president, but he's writing this letter on UFO disclosure, which Hillary, we have an actual document that shows that Hillary was one of the people. He gave this letter on UFO disclosure to the president, and she helped him edit it. And he would give it to everybody. "What do you think? What should I change?" And Hillary was one of the people that helped him. The other thing that Hillary did in one of the documents, it shows that all the material going from Lawrence Rockefeller to the science advisor and from the science advisor to Lawrence Rockefeller was going through Hillary Clinton's office, the first lady office. So she was involved. And so he was writing this letter, and he was getting more frustrated. It was going along. He wasn't getting the answers. And he managed to get Roswell to reinvestigate it, because they said, "You say this conspiracy is as big as you think it is. Well, instead of us just trying to get all the UFO information, just give us one case. We'll go after the one case. We'll get it declassified, and then we'll go after the rest of it if this is what you say is true." So he said, "Okay, we'll take Roswell." And that's why the Clinton administration ran another investigation on Roswell. It wasn't because the Air Force decided, "Oh, I think we should run an investigation on Roswell." It was because Clinton said, "Go out and reinvestigate Roswell."
Yeah, but then they printed that stupid story about the dummies falling.
Exactly. Okay. Yes. Well, not the dummies. There's two different stories. Oh. And this, when you see the two different stories, you understand how it happened. What happened is it came out in November of 1995. He saw the final report. And that was the one that said there's nothing to it. It was a Mogul balloon. But it doesn't talk about the bodies. And then what happened is they read the report. He goes to Belfast, Northern Ireland in late November 1995, and he's lighting the Christmas tree. And in this speech, and presidential speeches, if it's in the speech, it means something. It doesn't appear in the speech for nothing. And he says, Ryan, I got some letters. There's a bunch of kids writing letters. He says, I got some letters. I got one from Ryan. Ryan, if you're out in the audience tonight, here's the answer to your question. No, as far as I know, a UFO spaceship did not crash in Roswell, New Mexico. But if they did, if the U.S. Air Force did recover bodies, they didn't tell me about it, and I want to know. So the first report doesn't talk about the bodies. So Clinton, across the bow, he doesn't do it directly, takes a shot across the bow and says, you didn't talk about the bodies in the report. You explained to me about how these people identified the bodies. So they put a second report out in 1997. That's the one that has the dummies. And this is the walking around the president. Say, Mr. President, you asked about the bodies. Here's your answer to the bodies. And he was up against a brick wall. He was trying to.
But what does he do? So he doesn't believe that report, but then he can't challenge it. Is that what you're saying?
No, he basically, and this is a story that Stephen Greer told, that I basically believe Stephen Greer. There was a senior White House reporter there, Sarah McLendon, who, when Stephen Greer was pushing, Sarah McLendon was sort of backing the UFO people, and she was a senior White House reporter, and she asked Clinton, she said, why don't you do something about with the UFO people? Why don't you step up and do something? And Clinton said to her, Sarah, there's a government inside the government, and I don't control it. And that, I think, means about this bureaucratic thing, that it's the bureaucrats that run the thing, not the elected people. And even in 2005, he's talking about Roswell, and the host of this, he's in Hong Kong, and he's talking to this investment seminar, which you're probably referring to. And the guy says, because I'm running the thing, I can ask you this question, what happened to Roswell?
Right.
He talks to Roswell and stuff like that. And then he says, if you listen, he says, I'm probably not the first president that they've lied to, or that bureaucrats have tried to wait out.
Right.
So it's that he knows the basic story, but he can't get to the details. So what happened with the Rockefeller Ranch, the story you're referring to,
right.
is that Rockefeller, according to the story I heard, that Rockefeller had to get them away from Washington. He had to get them away from all the security and all this stuff. So he invites them to the ranch where he can get them by himself, away from Secret Service, away from all these things, and he's going to give them – he's frustrated. He wants to give them the briefing. So and we recovered – I filed the FOIA. We recovered the photos where we discovered that Hillary's got this book that Rockefeller gave her that talks about the philosophical implications of the discovery of extraterrestrial life.
What's the title of that book? Because that was great.
I think it was called The Philosophical Implications of the Discovery of Extraterrestrial Life. It was written by a professor from Arizona State University.
That's right. She has the book in her hands, and she's walking with Rockefeller. It's all right there. Yeah.
Yeah, as she's greeting him, and they're walking to the they're walking back to the ranch. I guess she's just gotten off the plane or the helicopter or whatever, and so it's evident that Rockefeller has given her this book, and she's walking there. And then supposedly what happened was, and it was Bill's birthday at the same time. There's lots of things happening. There's no record in the White House record what happened, but according to a number of people who talked to Rockefeller, what happened is he sat there and he told them he gave them his briefing of what he thought was going on and stuff like that. And they sat there and didn't say a thing. No comments, nothing. And the very next morning, Hillary came to breakfast and she said, okay, we listened to what you said, and don't ever bring up the subject again. And it always comes down to this thing that it comes down to election, that you don't want to be tagged with the UFO thing. If you see what happened to Kucinich in 2008, when he came out, his career was finished. I mean, it was game over. And they don't want to get tagged with this issue, because Hillary was stuck with this issue of channeling with Gene Houston, whole thing about channeling Eleanor Roosevelt and Gandhi. And then
I know that hit the headlines. But do you think Hillary might be making the run for the presidency in 2016 and reveal some of this stuff? She seems to be in a key position.
Absolutely. Nope. It's a game of, once you're in there, then you change sides. I wrote an article. It's on my website in the article section, the 64 reasons why they've decided not to tell you the truth. And what I say is if you suddenly get in there and you realize the fact that your career is over if you release this, or that, there's all these classified aspects, and it's like government now, they can't do anything. I mean, they can't solve the gun crisis. They can't solve the fiscal crisis. They just keep kicking the can down the road. The politicians are gutless, and it's basically you're looking at yourself for history, and you don't want to be the president that goes down as having, you know, got the UFO thing going and having the thing go south, because there's a lot of things that could happen. I mean, if you own Shell Oil, I've always said, I was told by Wilbur Smith, the guy who ran the Canadian government program, by his top scientist, he said to me, Grant, I'll tell you what. If you know the disclosure is happening tomorrow, you sell everything you got, because tomorrow nothing's going to be worth anything. And it basically comes down to is if you own Shell Oil and it's at $100 a share, and the rumor comes out that the president's going to release the fact that you don't need oil anymore. I mean, you don't need 2%. You don't need 100% of people to start selling Shell Oil. All you need is the big guys, and suddenly the thing's going to open at $32 and be heading south fast at the opening. And once all the people that are connected to Shell Oil sell, and then the other people that are spinoffs from Shell Oil sell, and the market starts to panic, and how do you turn it around? During the 9/11 crisis, the stock market crashed, but you could turn it around because you could convince the people that you're going to do something. We're going to put marshals on the plane. We're going to shoot anybody who stands up and tries to take over the plane. And everybody goes, maybe they got under control. But the UFO situation is different, because they have no control over what's going on. The aliens are running the show. And so you can't just say, okay, we're going to take care of it. If you leak it and then suddenly you get the president standing up there and he can't explain stop abductions, you say, Mr. President, you're constitutionally responsible for the protection of the American people. It's been estimated that millions of people have been abducted. Mr. President, what are you doing to stop it? He doesn't know how to stop it. He doesn't even know what's going on.
But you're still saying there's a slow leak, and it seems like there is a slow leak, and suddenly maybe the bathtub's full or something, but there's a slow leak that's that seems to be going on over the last, 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Right from the word go. Right from the start.
So
they cover it with disinformation. And what they do is they use people, like they use Burrish, Gordon Novell. Gordon Novell comes out, he shows you the script, he's running around talking about this. And so the idea that they've got this disclosure thing that they're trying to push to Spielberg is out there, but nobody believes it because it's Gordon Novell. They go, Gordon Novell, I wouldn't believe anything Gordon Novell says. And that's what they do. They use that same with Dan Smith. The main contact for Ronald Pandolfi is Dan Smith. And whenever I bring up Dan Smith, they say, well, you believe Dan Smith? You know, can't believe Dan Smith. The guy gets drunk, he gets on boards, he gets kicked off boards. The guy can't control his temper. Or Richard Doty. I mean, they use all these sort of sources where it's like a trap door. The Area 51 story that I tell, you get Bob Lazar, who they put, and there's no doubt that before Bob Lazar went on there, they knew that he knew John Lear. It was one of the questions in the interview, do you know John Lear? So they knew that he knew John Lear, who was big into UFOs. So why would they put him up at the base knowing that he's going to go back and tell John Lear all the stuff that he saw at Area 51? Because they wanted him to see the stuff. They wanted him to go tell John Lear. And because John Lear was talking about aliens eating people and all sorts of stuff in 1987, nobody's going to believe John Lear. The story's going to go away. And the story's going to get out that we've got crafts at Area 51. They want to get that out. But the problem was that George Knapp, the reporter, they didn't realize he was going to go on TV and that this thing was going to take off and that George Knapp was going to spend 6 months investigating the story and that he was going to get 24 other witnesses that backed up the story. And they didn't realize they're going to go viral, and they've got it under control. But they had lost control. They had people going up with buses up into to look at the base and stuff like that. So it's this thing of using disinformation and garbage around it and the people you're releasing it. I think they figure they've got it pretty much under control. The prime story is last year, Chase Brandon comes out. This guy is 35-year veteran of the CIA. 7 years under contract after that to the CIA. This guy was the second most powerful person inside the CIA to speak publicly on behalf of the CIA, except for the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, because he was the spokesman to Hollywood to try to influence Hollywood to spin the CIA story if there was a CIA aspect to the movie. So he could publicly speak on behalf of the CIA. He comes out and says, oh, by the way, I was at Langley headquarters, and I saw this box, and it had Roswell on the side. And I looked in, and they confirmed to me absolutely for sure that Roswell was for real and involved extraterrestrial bodies. This extremely high, powerful guy comes out and says this. Can he possibly say this without the approval of the CIA? If he had said, I saw a box that had Bin Laden on the side, and I looked inside the box, and it said that Bin Laden had been dead for years. I mean, the story would be all over America because it was a UFO story. He put it out there. I and a couple of researchers forced the CIA to make a statement, and they basically said, oh, we haven't found anything to confirm his story. And basically, it's like, that's it. You couldn't get him to talk after that. He told the story, and it just died away. And here's a top CIA guy saying Roswell was for real and had bodies, and nobody picked up on the story.
Yeah, why is that? Why didn't the mainstream at least pick up on that? Sometimes they do.
Because they hate the story. Number one, they don't have time, because most media is a 3-day news cycle. So you do the story. The guy who did the Chase Brannon story for Huffington Post did the story, got 1.5 million hits in a couple of days. And then he had to go do another story. So he went and did the British story because he's got another story to do. As opposed to
Lee Spiegel for the Huffington Post?
Lee Spiegel, yeah. So he went to do the British story, and the story just died out. He tried to get a follow-up interview with Chase Brannon, and Chase Brannon says, no, I really don't want to do an interview. And he basically controlled the whole thing, and the story just sort of died away. And the other thing is that reporters, you have this 3-day news cycle, and you have the thing that it's got this toxic issue that you really don't want. If you're a big reporter, you want to do the Middle East story or the economy story. You want to sound smart. UFOs in the present environment is not smart. And the prime example that tells of this is when Bill Clinton got in, and this is a story that's told by Webster Hubble, who was the assistant attorney general, who was friends with Hillary Clinton, who'd worked at the Rose Law Firm in Little Rock. And he tells the story. He goes in, and he comes out with a book in 1997. He releases his book. It was called Friends in High Places. And in the book, he says, when I got there, Bill said to me, if I put you over there in justice, here's what I want you to do. I want you to get the answer to two questions. Number one, who killed JFK? Number two, are there UFOs? I went. I couldn't get anything. So, of course, big time. He's going to jail. The Whitewater thing. Right. There's all sorts of scandals. He's a big name. So the story comes up in the presidential, the White House news conference the day after the book is released. And the press secretary is there answering the questions. And Deborah Orne, who works for the New York Post, who hated the Clintons, who did the stories of Monica Lewinsky and just hated the Clintons, raises the question. She says, Mr. Hubble had in his book the fact that Bill asked Hubble to go out and look for UFOs and the JFK assassination. What's your answer? And he sort of walked around the question talking about the alien, this Weekly World News alien. Everybody laughed. She comes back with a follow-up question. She says, is it true what Mr. Hubble writes in his book about what Mr. Clinton said? And the press secretary said, I'm not going to comment on what private people write in their private books. And Deborah Orne was interviewed later. She said, I sat there. This is a big story. I mean, this is a big story where a major guy has said this. And she asked the two questions. She said, I sat there and waited for somebody else in the White House press corps to ask another question. And they all rolled over and played dead. Because basically, if you're in the White House press corps, you worked your way from a little tiny reporter all the way up, and you got your little White House press pass, and you're standing there, you're not going to be the guy to ask the stupid UFO question, because they're never going to call on you again. They're never going to ask you a question again. And you're gone. If you work for the New York Post, if they're not going to ask you a question, we're putting somebody else in there. You're out of here. And nobody wants to embarrass. Everybody wants to look smart. Everybody wants to, play the game. And
yeah, but yet you're saying they drop the bombshells and then they run away from it, and then they'll drop another one in a couple of years. Going back to the 50s, they seem to be doing this. So there's some sort of game plan or big picture or something strange is going on there.
Yeah, I don't know what the ultimate game plan is. I mean, I can see that definitely with the what they're doing. It's pretty obvious what they're doing in a lot of these cases. Maybe they're just stalling for time, or they're trying to get the situation where if it does break, that you don't have people back in 1947 believing nothing. You have to sort of move people along so that when this thing does fall in there, that people are going to say, oh, that's not a big thing. Even now, I mean, one of the examples is when I got on one of these consciousness shows, and they do a lot of this. They interview on this universal consciousness and stuff, and they do a lot of atheists, and they fight you know, interview a lot of atheists, and they had Victor Stenger on. And Victor Stenger is talking about, you know, consciousness. They're, no, the brain is just the brain, and man is an accident. And if it hadn't been for a meteorite hitting the dinosaurs, mankind wouldn't exist. There'd be no life in the universe, advanced life in the universe. And so this argument's going on. And then he talks about evolution, the random theory of evolution, which I call the Powerball theory of evolution. And he said, I'm upset about this. I'm writing a book. I can't believe this. This is unbelievable that this is taught in school, and that scientists still say, oh, it doesn't affect the version of God. That, and it does. There is no God. You have to add that into the schools, and I'm writing a book on this whole thing. That's what the random theory is about, or he calls it natural theory. And he said, I can't believe it. There's only 16% of people in the United States believe the random theory. And I'm thinking to myself, 16%? And this is taught in school. Only 16%. The UFO idea that UFOs are here and they're extraterrestrial is 48%, at least 48%. The number of people that believe there's life in the universe is like 70%. I'm thinking, well, man, we're not doing too bad. We think that really not getting anywhere, and yet the numbers are going up, that more and more people are starting to believe that this is for real. And especially if you take, is the government lying about their statements about UFOs? It's up in the 70% that people believe the government is lying about UFOs.
Well, look at the two great speeches. Look at the Kennedy Secret Society speech, and then also the Eisenhower military complex.
Yeah.
Right. So they're giving us hints, and they, of course, they killed Kennedy. Somebody did, for sure. It wasn't, you know, wasn't a lone assassin. But there's a slow revelation that's happening as far as, you know.
I think they have to do. I sort of look at it like a lot of people look in ufology. Look at it like it's us versus them. We're the good guys. They're the evil guys. And I don't think, especially if you look at, like this disclosure that almost happened under Bush Sr. What I look at is that these guys are doing the best they can with what they've got. I don't think it's like the Bush guys are sitting there and they want oil forever and they want to ruin the life for, you know, ruin the world for their grandchildren and their great grandchildren and stuff. I think they're doing the best they can.
Right.
With what they've got, that they're trying to look at it, and they're trying to figure out what are we going to do with this. And it is a big. So I said, if you read this article on the reason, it's on my website. The reason why, 64 reasons why they've covered up. If you look at it, you go like, wow, man. You know, I think I'd probably do the same thing.
Yeah. No, so, I agree, and I think they're right. They're doing the best they can, and it is a slow revelation. Maybe it'll take 100 years, and. Just to sort of wrap up in terms of this whole scope of ideas we just put out there, we ultimately, it seems like we have to evolve our understanding of who we are as conscious beings. This is where we started.
And I think that's where the aliens are taking us. Yeah. I think the aliens are doing an end run around the government.
Yeah.
They're basically going to be the people that bring it out, because when it comes right down to it, the aliens are covering up as well. It's not just the government. I mean, the aliens could land anytime they wanted and announce themselves, but they're not. So they have a plan as well as the government.
Yeah, that's the kind of battle between disclosure and contact, and maybe they have the same game plan, that it's just going to take a long time for the actual awareness of humans to change in order to accept these possibilities. And, of course, our energy strategies will change.
Yeah, because in the end, it I say, and ufology people don't really are happy when I say it, but I say we're no different than any other social or political movement. If you take a look, Hillary Clinton made a speech about the women's right to vote. That it started in 1848, and they didn't get it till what, 1916, 1917. I mean, that was a long time just to get the right to vote.
Right. That's a really good point. You're absolutely right. We are a social movement that's looking like Stephen Bassett yelling, freedom, truth, all that. But it's a process. You're absolutely
right. You have to go through the thing, and there are no overnight successes, whether you look at Greenpeace or gay rights or anything. I mean,
or Obama being the first black president. I mean, that was a 100-year process or more.
Yeah. So I say, when it says, you know, people say, when is disclosure going to happen? I say, when we're ready for it. It's like when you've done your lessons, whether especially the aliens. I mean, they're not going to do your homework for you. You have to go and advance yourself and get the ideas yourself and move it yourself. They're not going to do it for you.
Well, because this is a huge game changer. It's look at what Copernicus did when he said, hey, guess what? You know, the Earth's not the center of the universe. This has implications that shake up us, shake up us as a conscious, as a race, as a human civilization. This affects everyone on all levels, and suddenly we're living in a whole different world than we ever thought was possible. I mean, that's so much sure. different than women's rights, black, gay. It's a huge game changer.
Yeah, and you have to. I can remember back in the 60s. I mean, if you talked about gays, it was still like, oh, come on, get serious. I mean, now when you got acclimatized, when it finally broke, it was like, well, you know, no, nobody really reacts to it. I think that's the same sort of thing. Is you know, you don't have if you tried to do, you know, the gays getting married back in the 60s. I mean, if you're a politician, they would have strung you up. Well, the people have to be ready for it when it finally arrives. And when it is, then it'll move slowly.
Right. I think that's a great point. And I think we are making progress, and the progress is constantly happening with conversations like this. And suddenly you have the download or that, hey, it has to do with consciousness, not just spacecrafts. And I think that's a huge contribution to the movement.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is a game changer, especially the consciousness thing, because a lot of stuff is going to be really at stake, because we do live in a world where, especially the scientific world, it's a materialistic world. It's a, like a clock.
But then again, with the quantum revolution, we're realizing, hey, maybe there's more to the world than just these things, and maybe it's energy, and maybe it's thought, and maybe it's intention. So,
but still, the scientific community has probably got the farthest to come. John Alexander's always, you know, open to talking about this. That in the National Academy of Sciences, that only 4% of people inside the National Academy of Sciences believe in any sort of paranormal, UFO type stuff.
But when you look at quantum physics and you say, hey, you can affect the experiment of light by looking at it, that's a quantum fact, and there you go.
Yeah, but they believe it at an atom – that's what I say. They believe it at a particle level that you can have these interaction ESP-type, sort of non-locality things. But if you say, well, you got non-locality with minds – then you get majority of scientists are saying, no. It's like, or even the UFO thing. I mean, how do they get here from there? People say they can't be coming because of the speed of light. In materials world, you can't do it.
But then you get the CIA backing the remote viewing project at Stanford Research Institute. So, you know, there's that.
Yeah. Well, they backed it, but then they shut it down, which was Pandolfi was responsible for, because it started to leak. Jim Mars was going to write a book in 1994, and they shut Jim Mars down. He couldn't even talk to his publisher. The editor disappeared and all this sort of stuff, and they killed the program. Ronald Pandolfi is very proud of saying he killed a remote.
But now it's all over the place. Now, you know, Hal Puthoff, Russell Targ, Ingo Swann, who just died. You Google remote viewing, you get 36 million hits on the website.
Okay, but the way it works is that if they'd got caught, if Jim Mars had been allowed to put that book out in 1994, then everybody would know the remote viewing program was for real, and then the CIA would have their program running. And you say, well, it doesn't work. And then you say, well, you're running the program. What do you mean it doesn't work? You've got this. So what they do is they kill the program because the security has been breached. So they kill the remote viewing program. Then they allow Jim Mars to publish his book because they say it's a bunch of garbage. And all you do is move it deeper black. Security's been violated. So you move it to the NSA and you continue to run it. And everybody, the vast majority of people say, well, the CIA said it didn't work. But they don't realize the mechanics of how that operated. All they've done is move the program.
Right. But of course, then we're talking about two levels of government or more that, deny it and fund it and then strategize about it and ridicule it. I mean, there's all these levels and levels of.
And the other thing is that with the CIA, you and I both know sort of the inner workings of this paranormal aspect of the CIA, but the vast majority of people would not have no idea that the CIA works on this kind of stuff. They just look at them as intelligence. They don't realize that they're interested in, or that they were interested in the 70s and, you know, Kirlian photography.
Well, the Russians were doing that all along. They wanted to catch up with the Russians.
So. Sure, So, but most people don't really realize how big a game that is for the CIA. And it makes sense when you look at the technologies involved. So you and I can discuss it. But I think in the public, it's still not very well known. And that's probably the message we got to get out, is that there are some high-level people that have looked at this and take it very seriously.
Well, of course, there was that movie, Man Who Stare at Goats. I haven't seen it, but that's supposed to be about the whole. So anyway, to wrap up, how would you like – I mean, of course, we covered a lot of the ground. I appreciate all the research and energy and excitement that you have for this subject, because that's the only way – you know, researchers like you are spreading the word and going deep into the files and confirming what everyone suspects. So how do you think, how would you like to leave people? And what's the book that you've just written, and how can people get it?
Well, the book I've just co-authored, it was a book that was originally done years ago, and then we just sort of added, it's called UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. And they can get it at my website, presidentialufo.com, or they can get it through Amazon. That book is more on the cover-up. It's more on the mechanics of how the Canadians knew, what the Americans knew early on, some of the big players, some of these aspects of the birds, you know, Ronald Pendolfi, Kit Green, all these sort of high level people who knew what was going on. But I'm more interested now in the consciousness thing, which I'm glad we had this discussion with your other guests.
Yeah, JJ.
And I think this is where it's got to go, and it's encouraging to have these conversations. And I think just by listening to it, people will make a move, and I think it raises everybody's understanding that this is not crazy stuff anymore, that there are some scientific stuff that's been done on this, and that we are getting somewhere. And I maybe leave it at that we are moving along. And if they look at my lectures or Dr. Hertak's stuff and start looking at this consciousness stuff, they'll realize that this is the next step that mankind has to take.
Thank you. Absolutely. This is definitely the next step of who we are, because I think only by expanding who we know ourselves to be will we really make contact, because ultimately there are no alien, it's all an aspect of consciousness. So
beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you, Grant.
I appreciate your interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I really appreciate the depth of research that you've done. So maybe we'll talk again at some point. So again, your website is Presidential UFOs?
PresidentialUFO.com.
Okay. Thanks a lot. And
beautiful.
Okay. We'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night. I've been talking to Grant Cameron about this whole idea of UFOs and consciousness. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com. There's a whole section there under UFOs where I have many interviews with people there. So thanks for listening. If you want to reach me, you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks. Good night.